Prologue. Snow. Three lanterns cast a flickering light, more than enough to illuminate the small room with its stark white walls and ceiling, but Cian kept her eyes fixed on the heavy wooden door. Illogical, she knew. Foolish in a sitter for the white. The weave of Saidar she had pushed around the jamb brought her occasional whispers of distant footsteps in the warren of hallways outside, whispers that faded away almost as soon as heard. A simple thing learned from a friend in her long-ago novice days, but she would have warning long before anyone came near. Few people came down as deep as the second basement, anyway. Her weave picked up the far-off chittering of rats. Light! How long since there had been rats in Tar Valon, in the tower itself? Were any of them spies for the Dark One? She wet her lips uneasily. Logic counted for nothing in this. True, if illogical. She wanted to laugh. With an effort, she crept back from the brink of hysteria. Think of something besides rats. Something besides... A muffled squeal rose in the room behind her, faltered into muted whimpering. She tried to stop up her ears. Concentrate. In a way, she and her companions had been led to this room because the heads of the Ajahs seemed to be meeting in secret. She herself had glimpsed Farana Neheran whispering in a secluded nook of the library with Jesse Bilal, who stood very high among the Browns, if not at the very top. She thought she was on firmer ground concerning Suana Dragand of the Yellows. She thought so. But why had Farana gone walking with Suana in a secluded part of the tower grounds, both swathed in plain cloaks? Sitters of different Ajahs still talked to one another openly, if coldly. The others had seen similar things. They would not give names from their own Ajahs, of course, but two had mentioned Farana. A troubling puzzle. The tower was a seething swamp these days, every Ajah at every other Ajah's throat, yet the heads met in corners. No one outside an Ajah knew for certain who within it led, but apparently the leaders knew each other. What could they be up to? What? It was unfortunate that she could not simply ask Farana, but even had Farana been tolerant of anyone's questions, she did not dare. Not now. Concentrate as she would, Cian could not keep her mind on the question. She knew she was staring at the door and worrying at puzzles she could not solve, just to avoid looking over her shoulder, toward the source of those stifled whimpers and snuffling groans. As if thinking of the sounds compelled her, she looked back slowly to her companions, her breath growing more uneven as her head moved by inches. Snow was falling heavily on Tar Valon far overhead, but the room seemed unaccountably hot. She made herself see. Brown-fringed shawl looped on her elbows, Saorin stood with her feet planted apart, fingering the hilt of the curved Altaran dagger thrust behind her belt. Cold anger darkened her olive complexion enough to make the scar along her jaw stand out in a pale line. Pevara appeared calmer at first glance, yet one hand gripped her red-embroidered skirts tightly, and the other held the smooth white cylinder of the oath rod like a foot-long club she was ready to use. She might be ready. Pevara was far tougher than her plump exterior suggested, and determined enough to make Saorin seem a shirker. On the other side of the chair of remorse, tiny Yukiri had her arms wrapped tightly around herself. The long, silvery-gray fringe on her shawl trembled with her shivers. Licking her lips, Yukiri cast a worried glance at the woman standing beside her. Doasine, looking more like a pretty boy than a yellow sister of considerable repute, displayed no reaction to what they were doing. She was the one actually manipulating the weaves that stretched into the chair, and she stared at the Turangrial, focusing so hard on her work that perspiration beaded on her pale forehead. They were all sitters, including the tall woman writhing on the chair. Sweat drenched Taline, matting her golden hair, soaking her linen shift till it clung to her. The rest of her clothes made a jumbled pile in a corner. Her closed eyelids fluttered, and she let out a constant stream of strangled moans and mewling half-uttered pleas. Cian felt ill, but could not drag her eyes away. Taline was a friend. Had been a friend. Despite its name, the Turangrial looked nothing like a chair, just a large rectangular block of marbled gray. Nobody knew what it was made of, but the material was hard as steel everywhere except the slanted top. The statuesque green sank a little into that, and somehow it molded itself to her, no matter how she twisted. Doisine's weavings flowed into the only break anywhere on the chair, a palm-sized rectangular hole in one side, with tiny notches spaced unevenly around it. Criminals caught in Tarvalin were brought down here to experience the chair of remorse, to experience carefully selected consequences of their crimes. On release, they invariably fled the island. There was very little crime in Tarvalin. Queasily, Cian wondered whether this was anything like the use the chair had been put to in the Age of Legends. "What is she seeing?" Her question came out a whisper in spite of herself. Talene would be more than seeing. To her, it all would seem real. Thank the light she had no warder, almost unheard of for a green. She had claimed a sitter had no need for one. Different reasons came to mind now.
"She is bloody being flogged by bloody Trollocs," Doisine said hoarsely.
Touches of her native Kyrian had appeared in her voice, something that seldom happened except under stress.
"When they are done, she can see the Trollocs' cook kettle boiling over a fire, and a murdral watching her. She must know it will be one or the other next. Burn me, if she doesn't break this time."
Doisine brushed perspiration from her forehead irritably and drew a ragged breath.
"Stop juggling my elbow. It has been a long while since I did this."
"Three times under," Yukiri muttered. "The toughest strong arm is broken by his own guilt, if nothing else, after two. What if she's innocent? Light, this is like stealing sheep with a shepherd watching." Even shaking, she managed to appear regal, but she always sounded like what she had been, a village woman. She glared around at the rest of them in a sickly fashion. "The law forbids using the chair on initiates. We'll all be unchaired. And if being thrown out of the hall isn't enough, we'll probably be exiled, and birched before we go just to drop salt in our tea. Burn me, if we're wrong, we could all be stilled." Cian shuddered. They would escape that last if their suspicions proved right. No, not suspicions, certainties. They had to be right. But even if they were, Yukiri was correct about the rest. Tower law seldom allowed for necessity or any supposed higher good. If they were right, though, the price was worth paying. Please, the light send they were right. "Are you blind and deaf?" Pivara snapped, shaking the oath rod at Yukiri. She refused to re-swear the oath against speaking an untrue word, and it had to be more than stupid green Aja pride after we'd all done as much already. When I shielded her, she tried to stab me. Does that shout innocence? Does it? For all she knew, we just meant to talk at her until our tongues dried up. What reason would she have to expect more? "Thank you both," Saren put in dryly, "for stating the obvious. It's too late to go back, Yukiri, so we might as well go forward. And if I were you, Pivara, I wouldn't be shouting at one of the four women in the whole tower I knew I could trust." Yukiri flushed and shifted her shawl, and Pivara looked a trifle abashed. A trifle. They might all be sitters, but Saren had most definitely taken charge. Cian was unsure how she felt about that. A few hours ago, she and Pivara had been two old friends, alone on a dangerous quest, equals reaching decisions together. Now they had allies. She should be grateful for more companions. They were not in the hall, though, and they could not claim sitter's rights on this. Tower hierarchies had taken over, all the subtle and not-so-subtle distinctions as to who stood where with respect to whom. In truth, Saren had been both novice and accepted twice as long as most of them, but 40 years as a sitter, longer than anyone else in the hall, counted for a great deal. Cian would be lucky if Saren asked her opinion, much less her advice, before deciding anything at all. Foolish, yet the knowledge pricked like a thorn in her foot.
"The Trollocs are dragging her toward the kettle," Doisine said suddenly, her voice grating.
A thin keening escaped through Talene's clenched teeth. She shook so hard she seemed to vibrate.
I do not know if I can flaming make myself..."
"Bring her awake," Saren commanded, without so much as glancing at anyone else to see what they thought. "Stop sulking, Yukiri, and be ready." The gray gave her a proud, furious stare, but when Doisine let her weaves fade and Talene's blue eyes fluttered open, the glow of Sidar surrounded Yukiri, and she shielded the woman lying on the chair without uttering a word. Saren was in charge, and everyone knew it, and that was that. A very sharp thorn. A shield hardly seemed necessary. Her face a mask of terror, Talene trembled and panted as though she had run 10 miles at top speed. She still sank into the soft surface, but without Doocine channeling, it no longer formed itself to her. Talene stared at the ceiling with bulging eyes, then squeezed them shut, but they popped right open again. Whatever memories lay behind her eyelids were nothing she wanted to face. Covering the 2 strides to the chair, Pevara thrust the oath rod at the distraught woman. "Forswear all oaths that bind you and retake the 3 oaths, Talene," she said harshly. Talene recoiled from the rod as from a poisonous serpent, then jerked the other way as Saren bent over her. "Next time, Talene, it's the cookpot for you. Or the Murdral's tender attentions." Saren's face was implacable, but her tone made it seem soft by comparison. "No waking up before. And if that doesn't do, there'll be another time and another, as many as it takes if we must stay down here until summer." Doocine opened her mouth in protest before giving over with a grimace. Only she among them knew how to operate the chair, but in this group she stood as low as Cian. Talene continued to stare up at Saren. Tears filled her big eyes and she began to weep, great shuddering, hopeless sobs. Blindly she reached out, groping until Pevara stuck the oath rod into her hand. Embracing the source, Pevara channeled a thread of spirit to the rod. Talene gripped the wrist-thick rod so hard that her knuckles turned white, yet she just lay there sobbing. Saren straightened. "I fear it's time to put her back to sleep, Doocine." Talene's tears redoubled, but she mumbled through them,
"I forswear all oaths that bind me."
With the last word, she began to howl. Cian jumped, then swallowed hard. She personally knew the pain of removing a single oath, and had speculated on the agony of removing more than one at once, but now the reality was in front of her. Talene screamed till there was no breath left in her, then pulled in air only to scream again, until Cian half expected people to come running down from the tower itself. The tall green convulsed, flinging her arms and legs about, then suddenly arched up, till only her heels and head touched the gray surface, every muscle clenched, her whole body spasming wildly. As abruptly as the seizure had begun, Talene collapsed bonelessly and lay there weeping like a lost child. The oath rod rolled from her limp hand down the sloping gray surface. Yukiri murmured something with the sound of a fervent prayer. Doocine kept whispering, "Light," over and over in a shaken voice. "Light, light." Pevara scooped up the rod and closed Talene's fingers around it again. There was no mercy in Cian's friend, not in this matter. "Now swear the 3 oaths," she spat. For an instant it seemed Talene might refuse, but slowly she repeated the oaths that made them all Aes Sedai and held them together. To speak no word that was not true. Never to make a weapon for one man to kill another. Never to use the one power as a weapon, except in defense of her life or that of her warder or another sister. At the end she began weeping in silence, shaking without a sound. Perhaps it was the oaths tightening down on her. They were uncomfortable when fresh. Perhaps. Then Pevara told the other oath they required of her. Talene flinched but muttered the words in tones of hopelessness.
"I vow to obey all 5 of you absolutely."
Otherwise she only stared straight ahead dully, tears trailing down her cheeks. "Answer me truthfully," Saren told her. "Are you of the Black Aja?"
"I am."
The words creaked, as if Talene's throat were rusty. The simple words froze Cian in a way she had never expected. She had set out to hunt the Black Aja, after all, and believed in her quarry as many sisters did not. She had laid hands on another sister, on a sitter, had helped bundle Talene along deserted basement hallways wrapped in flows of air, had broken a 12 tower laws, committed serious crimes, all to hear an answer she had been nearly certain of before the question was asked. Now she had heard. The Black Aja really did exist. She was staring at a black sister, a dark friend who wore the shawl, and believing turned out to be a pale shadow of confronting. Only her jaw, clenched near to cramping, kept her teeth from chattering. She struggled to compose herself, to think rationally, but nightmares were awake and walking the tower. Someone exhaled heavily, and Siane realized she was not the only one who found her world turned upside down. Yukiri gave herself a shake, then fixed her eyes on Talin as though determined to hold the shield on her by willpower if need be. Doasine was licking her lips and smoothing her dark golden skirts uncertainly. Only Saren and Pevara appeared at ease.
"So,"
Saren said softly. Perhaps faintly was a better word.
"So, Black Aja."
She drew a deep breath and her tone became brisk. "There's no more need for that, Yukiri. Talin, you won't try to escape or resist in any way. You won't so much as touch the source without permission from one of us. Though I suppose someone else will take this forward once we hand you over. Yukiri?" The shield on Talin dissipated, but the glow remained around Yukiri, as if she did not trust the effect of the rod on a black sister. Pevara frowned. "Before we give her to Elida, Saren, I want to dig out as much as we can. Names, places, anything. Everything she knows." Dark Friends had killed Pevara's entire family, and Siane was sure she would go into exile ready to hunt down every last black sister personally. Still huddled on the chair, Talin made a sound half-bitter laugh, half-weeping. "When you do that, we are all dead. Dead! Elida is Black Aja." "That's impossible," Siane burst out. "Elida gave me the order herself." "She must be," Doasine half-whispered. "Talin sworn the oaths again. She just named her." Yukiri nodded vehemently. "Use your heads," Pevara growled, shaking her own in disgust. "You know as well as I do if you believe a lie, you can say it for truth."
"And that is truth," Saren said firmly.
"What proof do you have, Talin? Have you seen Elida at your meetings?" She gripped her knife hilt so hard that her knuckles paled. Saren had had to fight harder than most for the shawl, for the right to remain in the tower at all. To her, the tower was more than home, more important than her own life. If Talin gave the wrong answer, Elida might not live to face trial. "They don't have meetings," Talin muttered sullenly. "Except the Supreme Council, I suppose. But she must be. They know every report she receives, even the secret ones, every word spoken to her. They know every decision she makes before it's announced. Days before, sometimes weeks. How else unless she tells them?" Sitting up with an effort, she tried to fix them each in turn with an intense stare. It only made her eyes seem to dart anxiously. "We have to run. We have to find a place to hide. I'll help you, tell you everything I know, but they'll kill us unless we run."
Strange, Siane thought, how quickly Talin had made her former cronies they and tried to identify herself with the rest of them.
No, she was avoiding the real problem, and avoidance was witless. Had Elida really set her to dig out the Black Aja? She had never once actually mentioned the name. Could she have meant something else? Elida had always jumped down the throat of anyone who even mentioned the Black. Nearly any sister would do the same, yet...
"Elida's proven herself a fool," Saren said, "and more than once I've regretted standing for her, but I'll not believe she's Black. Not without more than that."
Tight-lipped, Pevara jerked an agreeing nod. As a Red, she would want much more.
"That's as may be, Saren," Yukiri said, "but we cannot hold Talin long before the Greens start asking where she is. Not to mention the Black. We'd better decide what to do fast, or we'll still be digging at the bottom of the well when the rains hit."
Talin gave Saren a feeble smile that was probably meant to be ingratiating. It faded under the brown sitter's frown.
"We don't dare tell Elida anything until we can cripple the Black at one blow," Saren said finally. "Don't argue, Pevara, it's sense."
Pevara threw up her hands and put on a stubborn expression, but she closed her mouth.
"If Talin is right," Saren went on, "the Black knows about Siane, or soon will, so we must ensure her safety as much as we can. That won't be easy with only the five of us. We can't trust anyone until we are certain of them. At least we have Talin, and who knows what we'll learn before she's wrung out."
Talin attempted to look willing to be wrung out, but no one was paying her any mind. Siane's throat had gone dry. "We might not be entirely alone," Pivara said reluctantly. "Siane, tell them your little scheme with Zara and her friends."
"Scheme?" Saeron said. "Who's Zara?"
"Siane?
Siane!"
Siane gave a start.
"What?
Oh, Pivara and I uncovered a small nest of rebels here in the tower," she began breathily. 10 sisters sent to spread dissent."
Saeron was going to make sure she was safe, was she? Without so much as asking. She was a sitter herself. She had been Aes Sedai for almost 150 years. What right had Saeron or anyone to—
"Pivara and I have begun putting an end to that. We've already made one of them, Zara Dakan, take the same extra oath Talene did, and told her to bring Bernila Gelbarn to my rooms this afternoon without rousing her suspicions.
Light, any sister outside this room might be black. Any sister.
Then we will use those two to bring another until they have all been made to swear obedience. Of course, we'll ask the same question we put to Zara, the same we put to Talene.
The Black Aja might already have her name, already know she had been set hunting them. How could Saeron keep her safe?
Those who give the wrong answer can be questioned, and those who give the right can repay for a little of their treachery by hunting the Black under our direction.
Light. How?
When she was done, the others discussed the matter at some length, which could only mean that Saeron was unsure what decision she would make. Yukiri insisted on giving Zara and her confederates over to the law immediately, if it could be done without exposing their own situation with Talene. Pivara argued for using the rebels, though half-heartedly. The dissent they had been spreading centered around vile tales concerning the Red Aja and false dragons. Doasine seemed to be suggesting that they kidnap every sister in the tower and force them all to take the added oath, but the other three paid little attention to her. Siane took no part in the discussion. Her reaction to their predicament was the only possible one, she thought. Tottering to the nearest corner, she vomited noisily. Elaine tried not to grind her teeth. Outside, another blizzard pelted Camelin, darkening the midday sky enough that the lamps along the sitting room's paneled walls were all lit. Fierce gusts rattled the casements set into the tall, arched windows. Flashes of lightning lit the clear glass panes, and thunder boomed hollowly overhead. Thunder snow, the worst kind of winter storm, the most violent. The room was not precisely cold, but— spreading her fingers in front of the logs crackling in the broad marble fireplace, she could still feel a chill rising through the carpets layered over the floor tiles, and through her thickest velvet slippers, too. The wide black fox collar and cuffs on her red and white gown were pretty, but she was not sure they added any more of its warmth than the pearls on the sleeves. Refusing to let the cold touch her did not mean she was unaware. Where was Nynaeve? And Vandine? Her thoughts snarled like the weather. They should be here already. Light! I wish I could learn to go without sleep and they take their sweet time. No, that was unfair. Her formal claim for the Lion Throne was only a few days old, and for her, everything else had to take second place for the time being. Nynaeve and Vandine had other priorities, other responsibilities as they saw them. Nynaeve was up to her neck planning with Rihanna and the rest of the Knitting Circle how to spirit kinswomen out of Shan-Chan-controlled lands before they were discovered and collared. The kin were very good at staying low, but the Shan-Chan would not just pass them by for wilders the way Aes Sedai always had. Supposedly, Vandine was still shaken by her sister's murder, barely eating and hardly able to give advice of any sort. The barely eating part was true, but finding the killer consumed her. Supposedly walking the halls in grief at odd hours, she was secretly hunting the Dark Friend among them. 3 days earlier, just the thought of that could make Elaine shiver. Now it was one danger among many. More intimate than most, true, but only most. They were doing important tasks, approved and encouraged by Egwene, but she still wished they would hurry, selfish though it might be. Vandine had a wealth of good advice, the advantage of long experience and study, and Nynaeve's years dealing with the village council and the women's circle back in Emmons Field gave her a keen eye for practical politics, however much she denied it.
burn me. I have 100 problems, some right here in the palace, and I need them. If she had her way, Nynaeve Almira was going to be the Aes Sedai advisor to the next Queen of Andor. She needed all the help she could find, help she could trust. Smoothing her face, she turned away from the blazing hearth. 13 tall armchairs, carved simply but with a fine hand, made a horseshoe arc in front of the fireplace. Paradoxically, the place of honor, where the queen would sit if receiving here, stood farthest from the fire's heat, such as it was. Her back began to warm immediately and her front to cool. Outside, snow fell, thunder crashed, and lightning flared. Inside her head, too. Calm. A ruler had as much need of calm as any Aes Sedai. "It must be the mercenaries," she said, not quite managing to keep regret out of her voice. Armsmen from her estates surely would begin arriving inside a month, once they learned she was alive, but it might be spring before any significant numbers came, and the men Birgitta was recruiting would require half a year or more before they were fit to ride and handle a sword at the same time. "And hunters for the horn, if any will sign and swear?" There were plenty of both trapped in Camelin by the weather. Too many of both, most people said, carousing, brawling, troubling women who wanted no part of their attentions. At least she would be putting them to good use, to stop trouble instead of beginning it. She wished she did not think she was still trying to convince herself of that. Expensive, but the coffers will cover it. For a little while they would. She had better start receiving revenues from her estate soon. Wonder of wonders, the two women standing before her reacted in much the same fashion. Dialin gave an irritated grunt. A large round silver pin worked with Taravin's owl and oak was fastened at the high neck of her dark green dress, her only jewelry. A show of pride in her house, perhaps too much pride. The high seat of House Taravin was a proud woman altogether. Gray streaked her golden hair, and fine lines webbed the corners of her eyes, yet her face was strong, her gaze level and sharp. Her mind was a razor, or maybe a sword. A plain-spoken woman, or so it seemed, who did not hide her opinions. "Mercenaries know the work," she said dismissively, "but they are hard to control, Elaine. When you need a feather touch, they're liable to be a hammer, and when you need a hammer, they're liable to be elsewhere and stealing to boot. They are loyal to gold, and only as long as the gold lasts, if they don't betray for more gold first. I'm sure this once Lady Birgitta will agree with me." Arms folded tightly beneath her breasts and heeled boots planted wide, Birgitta grimaced, as always when anyone used her new title. Elaine had granted her an estate as soon as they reached Camelin, where it could be registered. In private, Birgitta grumbled incessantly over that, and the other change in her life. Her sky-blue trousers were cut the same as those she usually wore, billowing and gathered at the ankles, but her short red coat had a high white collar and wide white cuffs banded with gold. She was the Lady Birgitta Trehelion and the Captain General of the Queen's Guards, and she could mutter and whine all she wanted, so long as she kept it private. "I do," she growled unwillingly, and gave Dialin a not-quite-sidelong glare. The warder bond carried what Elaine had been sensing all morning. Frustration, irritation, determination. Some of that might have been a reflection of herself, though. They mirrored one another in surprising ways since the bonding, emotionally and otherwise. Why, her courses had shifted by more than a week to match the other woman's. Brigitte's reluctance to take the second-best argument was clearly almost as great as her reluctance to agree. "Hunters aren't much bloody better, Elaine," she muttered. "They took the hunter's oath to find adventure, and a place in the histories if they can, not to settle down keeping the law. Half are supercilious prigs looking down their flaming noses at everyone else. The rest don't just take necessary chances, they look for chances to take. And one whisper of a rumor of the Horn of Valyr, and you'll be lucky if only 2 in 3 vanish overnight." Dialin smiled a thin smile as though she had won a point. Oil and water were not in it compared to those two. Each managed well enough with nearly anyone else, but for some reason they could argue over the color of charcoal. Could and would.
Besides, hunters and mercenaries alike, nearly all are foreigners. That will sit poorly with high and low alike. Very poorly. The last thing you want is to start a rebellion. Lightning flared, briefly lighting the casements, and a particularly loud peal of thunder punctuated her words. In 1,000 years, 7 queens of Andor had been toppled by open rebellion, and the 2 who survived probably wished they had not. Elaine stifled a sigh. One of the small inlaid tables along the walls held a heavy silver rope-work tray with cups and a tall pitcher of hot spiced wine. Lukewarm spiced wine now. She channeled briefly. Fire and a thin wisp of steam rose from the pitcher. Reheating gave the spices a slight bitterness, but the warmth of the worked silver cup in her hands was worth it. With an effort, she resisted the desire to heat the air in the room with the power and released the source. The warmth would not have lasted unless she maintained the weaves, anyway. She had conquered her unwillingness to let go every time she took in Sidar. Well, to some extent. Yet, of late, the desire to draw more grew every time. Every sister had to face that dangerous desire. A gesture brought the others to pour their own wine. "You know the situation," she told them. "Only a fool could think it anything but dire, and you're neither of you fools." The guards were a shell, a handful of acceptable men and a double handful of strong arms and toughs better suited to throwing drunks out of taverns or being thrown out themselves. And with the Saldaeans gone and the Aiel leaving, crime was blooming like weeds in spring. She would have thought the snow would damp it down, but every day brought robbery, arson, and worse. Every day the situation grew worse. "At this rate we'll see riots in a few weeks, maybe sooner. If I can't keep order in Camelin itself, the people will turn against me." If she could not keep order in the capital, she might as well announce to the world that she was unfit to rule. "I don't like it, but it has to be done, so it will be." Both opened their mouths, ready to argue further, but she gave them no chance. She made her voice firm. "It will be done." Brigitte's waist-long golden braid swung as she shook her head, yet grudging acceptance filtered through the bond. She took a decidedly odd view of their relationship as Aes Sedai and warder, but she had learned to recognize when Elaine would not be pressed. After a fashion, she had learned. There was the estate, and title, and commanding the guards, and a few other small matters. Dialin bent her neck a fraction, and perhaps her knees. It might have been a curtsy, yet her face was stone. It was well to remember that many who did not want Elaine Trakand on the Lion Throne wanted Dialin Taravin instead. The woman had been nothing but helpful, but it was early days yet, and sometimes a niggling voice whispered in the back of Elaine's head. Was Dialin simply waiting for her to bungle badly before stepping in to save Andor? Someone sufficiently prudent, sufficiently devious, might try that route, and might even succeed. Elaine raised a hand to rub her temple, but made it into adjusting her hair. So much suspicion, so little trust. The game of houses had infected Andor since she left for Tar Valon. She was grateful for her months among Aes Sedai for more than learning the power. Desdemar was breath and bread to most sisters. Grateful for Tom's teaching, too. Without both, she might not have survived her return as long as she had. The light scent Tom was safe, that he and Matt and the others had escaped the Shan Chan and were on their way to Camelin. Every day since leaving Ebu Dar she prayed for their safety, but that brief prayer was all she had time for now. Taking the chair at the center of the Ark, the Queen's chair, she tried to look like a queen, back straight, her free hand resting lightly on the carved chair arm. "Looking a queen is not enough," her mother had told her often. "But a fine mind, a keen grasp of affairs, and a brave heart will go for nothing if people do not see you as a queen." Brigitte was watching her closely, almost suspiciously. Sometimes the bond was decidedly inconvenient. Dialin raised her wine cup to her lips. Elaine took a deep breath. She had harried this question from every direction she knew, and she could see no other way. "Brigitte, by spring, I want the guards to be an army equal to anything 10 houses can put in the field. Impossible to achieve, likely, but just trying meant keeping the mercenaries who signed now and finding more, signing every man who showed the least inclination,
Light, what a foul tangle. Dialin choked, her eyes bulging. Dark wine sprayed from her mouth. Still spluttering, she plucked a lace-edged handkerchief from her sleeve and dabbed at her chin. A wave of panic shot down the bond from Birgitta. "Oh, burn me, Elaine! You can't mean... I'm an archer, not a general. That's all I've ever been. Don't you understand yet? I just did what I had to do, what circumstances forced on me. Anyway, I'm not her anymore. I'm just me, and..." She trailed off, realizing she might have said too much. Not for the first time. Her face went crimson as Dialin eyed her curiously. They had put it about that Birgitta was from Candor, where country women wore something like her clothes, yet Dialin clearly suspected the lie. And every time Birgitta let her tongue slip, she came closer to letting her secret slip, too. Elaine shot her a look that promised a talking to later. She would not have thought Birgitta's cheeks could get any redder. Mortification drowned everything else in the bond, flooding through until Elaine felt her own face coloring. Quickly she put on a stern expression, hoping her crimson cheeks would pass for something other than an intense desire to squirm in her seat with Birgitta's humiliation. That mirroring effect could be more than merely inconvenient. Dialin wasted only a moment on Birgitta. Tucking her handkerchief back in its place, she carefully set her cup back on the tray, then planted her hands on her hips. Her face was a thunderhead now. "The guards have always been the core of Andor's army, Elaine, but this... Light's mercy, this is madness. You could turn every hand against you from the River Arranon to the Mountains of Mist." Elaine focused on calm. If she was wrong, Andor would become another Kyrian, another blood-soaked land filled with chaos. And she would die, of course, a price not high enough to meet the cost. Not trying was unthinkable, and in any case would have the same result for Andor as failure. Cool, composed, steely calm. A queen could not show herself afraid, even when she was, especially when she was. Her mother had always said to explain decisions as seldom as possible. The more often you explained, the more explanations were necessary, until they were all you had time for. Gareth Bryn said to explain if you could. Your people did better if they knew the why as well as the what. Today she would follow Gareth Bryn. A good many victories had been won by following him. "I have 3 declared challengers, and maybe 1 not declared." She made herself meet Dialin's gaze. Not angrily, just eyes meeting eyes. Or maybe Dialin did take it for anger, with her jaw tight and her face flushed. If so, so be it. By herself, Aramilla is negligible, but Nason has joined House Cairn to her, and whether or not he's sane, his support means she must be considered. Nayan and Elenia are imprisoned. Their armsmen are not. Nayan's people may dither and argue until they find a leader, but Jared is High Seat of Sarand, and he will take chances to feed his wife's ambition. House Baren and House Anshar flirt with both. The best I can hope is that 1 goes with Sarand and 1 with Aron. 19 houses in Andor are strong enough that smaller houses will follow where they lead. 6 are arrayed against me, and I have 2. 6 so far, and the light send she had 2. She would not mention the 3 great houses that had all but declared for Dialin. At least Egwene had them tied down in Murundi for now. She motioned to a chair near her, and Dialin sat, carefully arranging her skirts. The storm clouds had left the older woman's face. She studied Elaine, giving no hint as to her questions or conclusions. "I know all that as well as you, Elaine, but Luan and Elorian will bring their houses to you, and Abella will as well, I'm sure." A careful voice, too, but it gathered heat as she went on. "Other houses will see reason, then, as long as you don't frighten them out of reason. Light, Elaine, this is not a succession. Trakand succeeds Trakand, not another house. Even a succession has seldom come to open fighting. Make the guards into an army and you risk everything." Elaine threw her head back, but her laughter held no amusement. It fit right in with the peals of thunder. "I risked everything the day I came home, Dialin. You say Norwellen and Tremaine will come to me, and Pendar? Fine, then I have 5 to face 6. I don't think the other houses will see reason, as you put it. If any of them move before it's clear as good glass the rose crown is mine, it will be against me, not for. With luck, those lords and ladies would shy away from associating with cronies of Gabriel, but she did not like depending on luck. She was not Matt Cawthon. Light. Most people were sure Rand had killed her mother, and few believed that Lord Gabriel had been one of the Forsaken. Mending the damage Ravine had done in Andor might take her entire lifetime, even if she managed to live as long as the kinswomen. Some houses would stand aside from supporting her because of the outrages Gabriel had perpetrated in Morghese's name, and others because Rand had said he intended to give her the throne. She loved the man to her toes, but burn him for giving voice to that, even if it was what reigned in Dailan. The meanest crofter in Andor would shoulder his scythe to pull a puppet from the lion throne. "I want to avoid Andoran killing Andoran if I can, Dailan, but succession or no succession, Jared is ready to fight, even with Alania locked away. Nayan is ready to fight. Best to bring both women to Camelin as soon as possible. Too much chance of them slipping messages and orders out of Arangil. Aramilla is ready with Nason's men behind her. To them, this is a succession, and the only way to stop them from fighting is to be so strong they don't dare. If Brigitte can build the guards into an army by spring, well and good, because if I don't have an army before then, I will have need of one. And if that isn't enough, remember the Seanchan. They won't be satisfied with Tanchico and Ebu Dar. They want everything. I won't let them have Andor, Dailan, any more than I'll let Aramilla." Thunder roared overhead. Twisting a little to look back at Brigitte, Dailan moistened her lips. Her fingers plucked unconsciously at her skirts. Very little frightened her, but tales of the Seanchan had. What she murmured, though, as if to herself, was, "I had hoped to avoid outright civil war." And that might mean nothing, or a great deal. Perhaps a little probing might show which. "Gawain," Brigitte said suddenly. Her expression had lightened, and so had the emotions flowing through the bond. Relief stood out strong. "When he comes, he'll take command. He'll be your first prince of the sword." "Mother's milk in a cup," Elaine snapped, and lightning flared in the windows for emphasis. Why did the woman have to change the subject now? Dailan gave a start, and heat flooded back into Elaine's face. By the older woman's gaping mouth, she knew exactly how coarse that curse was. Strangely embarrassing, that. It should not have counted for anything that Dailan had been her mother's friend. Unthinking, she took a deep swallow of wine, and nearly gagged at the bitterness. Quickly, she suppressed images of Lini threatening to wash out her mouth, and reminded herself that she was a grown woman with a throne to win. She doubted her mother had ever found herself feeling foolish so often. "Yes, he will, Brigitte," she went on more calmly. "When he comes." Three couriers were on their way to Tar Valon. Even if none managed to get past Elida, Gawain would learn eventually that she had made her claim, and he would come. She needed him desperately. She had no illusions of herself as a general, and Brigitte was so fearful she could not live up to the legends about her that sometimes she seemed afraid to try. Face an army, yes. Lead an army, never under the sun. Brigitte was well aware of the tangle in her own mind. Right that moment her face was frozen, but her emotions were full of self-anger and embarrassment, with the first growing stronger by the moment. With a stab of irritation, Elaine opened her mouth to pursue Dailan's mention of civil war before she began reflecting Brigitte's anger. Before she could utter a word, though, the tall red doors opened. Her hopes for Nynaeve or Van Deen were dashed by the entrance of two seafolk women, barefoot despite the weather. A cloud of musky perfume wafted ahead of them, and by themselves they made up a procession in bright brocaded silk trousers and blouses, jeweled daggers and necklaces of gold and ivory, and other jewelry. Straight black hair with white at the temples nearly hid the 10 small fat golden rings in Renila Din Kalan's ears, but the arrogance in her dark eyes was as plain as the medallion-laden golden chain that connected one earring to her nose ring. Her face was set, and despite a graceful sway to her walk, she appeared ready to stride through a wall. Nearly a hand shorter than her companion and darker than charcoal,
Zaida Din Parida wore half again as many golden medallions dangling on her left cheek, and carried an air of command, rather than arrogance, a sure certainty that she would be obeyed. Grey flecked her cap of tight black curls, yet she was stunning, one of those women who grew more and more beautiful as they aged. Dailin flinched at sight of them, and half raised a hand to her nose before she could stop herself, a common enough reaction in people unused to the Atha An Mier. Elaine grimaced, and not for their nose rings. She even considered another curse, something still more pungent. Excepting the Forsaken, she could not have named two people she wanted less to see right then. Rena was supposed to see this did not happen. "Forgive me," she said, rising smoothly, "but I am very busy now. Matters of state, you understand, or I would greet you as your stations deserve." The sea folk were sticklers for ceremony and propriety, at least on their own terms. Very likely they had gotten past the first maid by simply not telling her they wanted to see Elaine, but they easily might take offense if she greeted them sitting before the crown was hers. And the light burned both of them, she could not afford to offend. Birgitta appeared at her side, bowing formally to take her cup. The warder bond carried wariness. She was always ginger around the sea folk. She had let her tongue slip around them, too. "I will see you later in the day," Elaine finished, adding, "the light willing." They also were great ones for ceremonial turns of phrase, and that one showed courtesy and gave a way out. Renila did not stop until she stood right in front of Elaine and much too close. One tattooed hand gestured curt permission for her to sit. "Permission?" "You have been avoiding me." Her voice was deep for a woman, and as chill as the snow falling on the roof. "Remember that I am windfinder to Nesta Din Rias Tumuns, mistress of the ships to the Atha An Mier. You still must fulfill the rest of the bargain you made for your white tower." The sea folk knew of the division in the tower. By this time everyone and her sister knew, but Elaine had not seen fit to add to her difficulties by making public which side she was on. Not yet. Renila finished on an imperious, commanding note. "You will deal with me, and now." So much for ceremony and propriety. "She has been avoiding me, I think. Not you, Windfinder." In contrast to Renila, Zaida sounded as though she were merely making conversation. Rather than rushing across the carpets, she moved idly about the room, pausing to touch a tall vase of thin green porcelain, then rising on her toes to peer through a four-barreled kaleidoscope atop a tall stand. When she glanced toward Elaine and Renila, an amused glint twinkled in her black eyes. After all, the bargain was with Nesta Din Rias, speaking for the ships. In addition to wave mistress of Clan Catalar, Zaida was an ambassador from the mistress of the ships. To Rand, not Andor, but her warrant gave the authority to speak and bind for Nesta herself. Changing one gold-chased barrel for another, she went on tiptoe to look through the eyepiece again. "You promised the Atha An Mier 20 teachers, Elaine. So far you have delivered one." Their entrance had been so sudden, so dramatic, that Elaine was surprised to see Marilla turn from closing the doors. Shorter still than Zaida, the Grey Sister was elegant in dark blue wool trimmed with silvery fur and sewn with small moonstones across the bodice, yet barely more than 2 weeks teaching the Windfinders had brought changes. Most were powerful women with a thirst for knowledge, more than ready to squeeze Marilla like a grape in the wine press, demanding the last drop of juice. Once Elaine had thought her self-possessed beyond the ability to surprise, but now Marilla was constantly wide-eyed, her lips always a little parted, as though she had just been startled half out of her wits, and expected to be startled again any moment. Folding her hands at the waist, she waited by the doorway, and appeared relieved to be out of the center of attention. Harumphing loudly, Dailin got to her feet and scowled at Zaida and Renila both. "Have a care how you speak," she growled. "You are in Andor now, not on one of your ships, and Elaine Trakand will be queen of Andor. Your bargain will be met in good time. For now we have more important matters to contend with." "Under the light there are none more important,"
Renila rumbled in turn, rounding on her. You say the bargain will be met, so you stand surety. Know there will be room to dangle you by your ankles in the rigging as well if...
Zaida snapped her fingers. That was all, but a tremor passed through Renila. Snatching the golden scent box dangling from one of her necklaces, she pressed it to her nose and breathed deeply. Windfinder to the mistress of the ships she might be, a woman of great authority and power among the Atha'an Mier, but to Zaida she was a windfinder, which grated her pride excessively. Elaine was sure there must be a way to use that to keep them out of her hair, but she had not found it yet. Oh, yes, for good or ill, Desdemar was in her bones now. She glided around a silently furious Renila as if around a column, a part of the room, though not toward Zaida. If anyone had a right to be casual here, she did. She could not afford to give Zaida a hair of advantage, or the wave mistress would shave her scalp for the wig makers. At the fireplace, she spread her hands in front of the flames again. Nesta Din Rias trusted we would fulfill the bargain, or she never would have agreed to it, she said calmly. You have regained the Bowl of the Winds, but assembling 19 more sisters to join you requires time. I know you worry about the ships that were at Ebu Dar when the Shan Chan came. Have Renila make a gateway to Tyr. There are hundreds of Atha'an Mier vessels there. Every report said so. You can learn what they know and rejoin your people. They will have need of you against the Shan Chan, and she would be rid of them. The other sisters will be sent to you as soon as can be arranged. Marilla did not move from the doorway, but her face took on a green tinge of panic at the possibility of being alone among the sea folk. Zaida gave over looking through the kaleidoscope and eyed Elaine sideways. A smile quirked her very full lips. I must remain here, at least until I speak with Randall Thor. If he ever comes. That smile tightened for an instant before blooming once more. Rand would have a hard time with her. And I will keep Renila and her companions for the time. A handful of windfinders more or less will make no great difference against these Shan Chan, and here, the light willing, they may learn what will be useful. Renila snorted, just loudly enough to be heard. Zaida frowned briefly and began fiddling with the eyepiece that stood level with the top of her head. "There are 5 Aes Sedai here in your palace, counting yourself," she murmured thoughtfully. "Perhaps some of you might teach," as though the idea had just occurred to her. And if that were so, Elaine could lift both seafolk women with one hand. "Oh, yes, that would be wonderful," Marilla burst out, taking a step forward. Then she glanced at Renila and subsided, a blush suffusing her Kyrianan paleness. Folding her hands at her waist once more, she snatched meekness around herself like a second skin. Brigitte shook her head in amazement. Dailin stared as if she had never seen the Aes Sedai before. "Something may be worked out, if the light pleases," Elaine said cautiously. Not rubbing at her temples took effort. She wished she could blame the ache inside her skull on the incessant thunder. Nynaeve would erupt at the suggestion, and Van Deen likely would ignore any such order, but Kariana and Saritha might be possible. "For no more than a few hours a day, you understand, when they have time." She avoided looking at Marilla. Even Kariana and Saritha might rebel at being tossed into that wine press. Zaida touched the fingers of her right hand to her lips. "It is agreed, under the light." Elaine blinked. That was ominous. In the wave mistress's eyes, apparently, they had just made another bargain. Her limited experience of dealing with the Atha'an Mier was that you were lucky to walk away with your shift. Well, this time things were going to be different. For instance, what were the sisters to gain in it? There had to be 2 sides to a bargain. Zaida smiled as if she knew what Elaine was thinking and was amused. One of the doors opening again was almost a relief, giving her an excuse to turn away from the seafolk woman. Rena Harfor slipped into the room with deference but without servility, and her curtsy was restrained, suitable for the high seat of a powerful house to her queen. But then any high seat worth a pinch of salt knew enough to offer respect to the first maid. Her graying hair was arranged in a bun, like a crown atop her head,
and she wore a scarlet tabard over her red and white dress, with the white line of Andor's head resting on her formidable bosom. Rena had no say in who would sit on the throne, but she had adopted full formal dress on the day of Elaine's arrival, as if the queen already were in residence. Her round face hardened momentarily at sight of the Atha'an Mier women who had bypassed her, but that was all the notice she gave them. For now, they would learn to their cost what incurring the animosity of the First Maid entailed.
"Mazrim, time has come at last, my lady."
Rena managed to make that sound very like, "my queen."
"Shall I tell him to wait?"
"Not before time," Elaine muttered in her head. She had summoned the man 2 days ago.
"Yes, Mistress Harfour, give him wine, the third best, I think. Inform him that I will see him as soon as I—"
Taim strode into the room as though he owned the palace. She did not need him named. Blue and gold dragons wove round the sleeves of his black coat from elbows to cuffs, in imitation of the dragons on Rand's arms, though she suspected he would not appreciate the observation. He was tall, nearly as tall as Rand, with a hooked nose and dark eyes like augurs, a physically powerful man who moved with something of a warder's deadly grace, but shadows seemed to follow him, as if half the lamps in the room had gone out. Not real shadows, but an air of imminent violence that seemed palpable enough to soak up light. Two more black-coated men followed at his heels, a bald fellow with a long grizzled beard and leering blue eyes, and a younger man, snake-slim and dark-haired, with the sneering arrogance young men often adopted before they learned better. Both wore the silver sword and red enameled dragon on their tall collars. None of the three carried a sword on his hip, though. They did not need swords. Suddenly the sitting room felt smaller and crowded. Instinctively, Elaine embraced Sidar and reached out to Link. Marilla slipped into the circle easily. Astoundingly, so did Renila. A quick glance at the windfinder lessened her surprise. Her face gray, Renila was gripping the dagger thrust behind her sash so hard that Elaine could feel the pain in her knuckles through the link. She had been in Camelin long enough to be aware of what an Ashaman was. The men knew someone had embraced Sidar, of course, even if they could not see the glow surrounding the three women. The bald man stiffened. The slim young man clenched his fists. They stared with angry eyes. Surely they had seized Sidine. Elaine began to regret giving in to reflex, but she was not going to let go of the source, not now. Taim radiated danger the way a fire gave heat. She drew deeply through the link, to the point where the overwhelming sense of life became sharp, warning prickles. Even those felt joyous. With that much of the power in her, she could lay waste to the palace, but she wondered whether it was enough to match Taim and the other two. She very much wished she had one of the three Angreal they had found in Ebudar, now safely locked away with the rest of the things from the cache until she had time to study them again. Taim shook his head contemptuously, a half-smile flickering across his lips.
"Use your eyes."
His voice was quiet, but hard and sneering.
"There are Two Eyes Sedai here." "Are you afraid of Two Eyes Sedai? Besides, you don't want to frighten the future Queen of Andor."
His companions relaxed visibly, then began trying to emulate the unthinking dominance of his stance. Rena knew nothing of Sidar or Sidine. She had rounded on the men, scowling as soon as they entered. Ashaman or no Ashaman, she expected people to behave as they should. She muttered something almost under her breath. Not quite far enough under, though. The words, "sneaking rats," were just audible. The First Maid reddened when she realized everyone in the room had heard, and Elaine got a chance to see Rena Harfour flustered. Which was to say that the woman drew herself up and said, with a grace and dignity any ruler might envy,
"Forgive me, my Lady Elaine, but I've been told there are rats infesting the storerooms. Most unusual this time of year, and so many of them. If you will excuse me, I must make sure my orders for rat-catchers and poison baits are being carried out."
"Stay," Elaine told her coolly, calmly.
"Vermin can be dealt with in due time."
Two Eyes Sedai. He did not realize Renila could channel, and he had emphasized, too. Would just three women give some advantage? Or did it take more?
Plainly the Ashaman knew of some advantage to women in numbers less than a circle of 13. Walk in on her without so much as a buy or leave, would they? You can show these good men out when I'm done with them. Taim's companions scowled at being called Goodman, but the man himself merely flashed another of those almost smiles. He was quick enough to know she had been thinking of him when she spoke of vermin. Light. Maybe Rand had needed this man once, but why would he keep him now, and in a position of such authority? Well, his authority counted for nothing here. Unhurriedly, she took her chair again and gave a moment to adjusting her skirts. The men would have to come around in front of her like supplicants, or else talk to the side of her head while she refused to look at them. For an instant she considered passing control of the small circle. The Ashaman would surely focus their attention on her. Ranila was still gray, though, anger and fear tumbling over one another inside her. She might strike out as soon as the link was hers. Marilla had some fear, just under control, mixed with a very great deal of a goosey feeling that matched her wide eyes and parted lips. The light alone knew what she might do with the link. Dialin glided to the side of Elaine's chair as if to shield her from the Ashaman. Whatever lay inside the high seat of Taravin, her face was stern, unfrightened. The other women had wasted no time in preparing as best they could. Zaida stood very still beside the kaleidoscope, doing her best to look diminutive and harmless, but her hands were behind her back, and the dagger was missing from behind her sash. Birgitta lounged beside the fireplace, left hand propped on the jamb, seemingly at her ease, but the sheath of her belt knife was empty, and from the way her other hand rested by her side, she was ready for an underhand throw. The bond carried focus. Arrow knocked, drawn to cheek, ready to loose. Elaine made no effort to look around Dialin at the three men. "First you are too slow obeying my summons, Master Taim, and then too sudden. Light, was he holding Sidene? There were methods of interfering with a man channeling short of shielding him, but it was a difficult skill, chancy, and she knew little more than the theory. He did come in front of her, several paces off, but he did not look a supplicant. Mazrim Taim knew who he was and his own worth, though he plainly set it higher than the sky. Lightning flashing in the windows sent strange lights across his face. Many would feel overawed by him, even without his fancy coat or his infamous name. She did not. She would not. Taim rubbed his chin thoughtfully. "I understand you've taken down the dragon banners all over Camelin, Mistress Elaine." There was amusement in his deep voice, if none in his eyes. Dialin hissed in fury at the slight to Elaine, but he ignored her. "The Saldaeans have withdrawn to the Legion of the Dragon's camp, I hear, and soon the last of the Aiel will be in camps outside the city as well. What will he say when he learns?" There was no doubt who he meant. "And after he's sent you a gift, too, from the south. I'll have it delivered later." "I will ally Andor with the Dragon Reborn in due course," she told him coldly. "But Andor is not a conquered province, not for him or anyone else." She made her hands stay relaxed on the arms of the chair. Light, talking the Aiel and Saldaeans into leaving had been her biggest achievement yet, and even with the flare-up in crime it had been necessary. "In any case, Master Taim, it is not your place to call me to task. If Rand objects, I will deal with him." Taim raised an eyebrow, and that odd quirk of his mouth lingered. "Burn me," she thought indignantly. "I shouldn't have used Rand's name." The man clearly thought he knew exactly how she would deal with the anger of the bloody dragon reborn. The worst of it was, if she could trip Rand into a bed, she would. Not for this, not to deal with him, but because she wanted to. What sort of gift had he sent her? Anger hardened her voice. Anger at Time's tone, at Rand for staying away so long, at herself for blushing and thinking of gifts. Gifts! "You've walled in 4 miles of Andor." Light, that was more than half as large as the inner city. How many of these fellows could it hold? The thought made her skin crawl. "With whose permission, Master Taim? Don't tell me the Dragon Reborn. He has no right to give permission for anything in Andor.
Dailin shifted beside her.
No right, but enough strength could make right. Elaine kept her attention on Taim. You've refused the Queen's Guard's entry to your compound. Not that they had tried before she came home. The law in Andor runs over all of Andor, Master Taim. Justice will be the same for lord or farmer or Ashaman. I won't claim I can force my way in.
He began to smile again, or nearly so.
I wouldn't demean myself, but unless the Queen's Guards are allowed in, I promise you not so much as a potato will go through your gates either. I know you can travel. Let your Ashaman spend their days traveling to buy food.
The almost smile vanished in a faint grimace. His boots shifted slightly. Annoyance lasted only an instant, though.
Food is a small problem, he said smoothly, spreading his hands. As you say, my men can travel. To anywhere I command. I doubt you could stop me buying whatever I want, even 10 miles from Camelin, but it wouldn't bother me if you could. Still, I am willing to allow visits whenever you ask. Controlled visits, with escorts at all times. The training is hard in the Black Tower. Men die almost every day. I would not want any accidents.
He was irritatingly accurate on how far from Camelin her writ ran, but no more than irritating. Were his remarks about traveling anywhere he commanded and accidents meant to be veiled threats? Surely not. A wave of fury ran through her as she realized that she was certain he would not threaten her because of Rand. She would not hide behind Randall Thor. Controlled visits? When she asked? She ought to burn the man to a cinder where he stood. Abruptly, she became aware of what was coming through the bond from Birgitta. Anger, a reflection of hers, joining with Birgitta's, reflecting from Birgitta to her, bouncing from her to Birgitta, feeding on itself, building. Birgitta's knife hand quivered with the desire to throw. And herself? Fury filled her. A whisker more and she would lose Sidar, or lash out with it. With an effort she forced rage down into a semblance of calm, a rough, seething semblance. She swallowed and struggled to keep her voice level. The guards will visit every day, Master Taim. And how she was to manage that in this weather she did not know. Perhaps I will come myself with a few other sisters. If the thought of having Aes Sedai inside his Black Tower upset Taim, he did not show it. Light, she was trying to establish Andor's authority, not goad the man. Hurriedly she did a novice exercise, the river contained by the bank, seeking calm. It worked, a little. Now she merely wanted to throw all the wine cups at him. I will accede to your request for escorts, but nothing is to be hidden. I won't have crimes concealed by your secrets. Do we understand one another? Taim's bow was mocking, but there was a tightness in his voice.
I understand you perfectly. Understand me, though. My men are not farmers knuckling their foreheads when you pass. Press an Ashaman too hard, and you may learn just how strong your law is.
Elaine opened her mouth to tell him exactly how strong the law was in Andor.
It is time, Elaine Trakand, a woman's voice said from the doorway.
Blood and ashes, Dailin muttered. Is the whole world just going to walk in here? Elaine recognized the new voice. She had been expecting this summons without knowing when it would come. Knowing that it must be obeyed, though, on the instant. She stood, wishing she could have a little longer to make matters clear to Taim. He frowned at the woman who had just entered, and at Elaine, clearly uncertain what to make of this. Good. Let him stew until she had time to set him straight on what special rights Ashaman had in Andor. Nadir stood as tall as either of the two men by the door, a wide woman, as close to stout as any Aiel Elaine had seen. Her green eyes examined the pair for a moment before dismissing them as unimportant. Ashaman did not impress wise ones. Very little did. Adjusting her dark shawl on her shoulders in a clatter of bracelets, she walked over in front of Elaine, her back to Taim. Despite the cold, she wore only that shawl over her thin white blouse, though, oddly, she carried a heavy wool cloak draped across one arm.
"You must come now," she told Elaine, "without delay."
Taim's eyebrows seemed to be climbing his forehead. No doubt he was unaccustomed to being so thoroughly ignored. "Light of heaven," Dailin breathed, massaging her forehead. "I don't know what this is about, Nadir, but it will have to wait until—" Elaine laid a hand on her arm. "You don't know, Dailin, and it can't wait. I will send everyone away and come with you, Nadir." The wise one shook her head disapprovingly. "A child waiting to be born cannot take time to send people away." She shook out the thick cloak. "I brought this to shield your skin from the cold. Perhaps I should leave it and tell Avienda your modesty is greater than your desire for a sister." Dailin gasped in sudden realization. The warder bond quivered with Brigitte's outrage. There was only one choice possible. No choice, really. Letting the link to the other two women dissolve, she released Sidar herself. The glow remained around Renila and Marilla, though. "Will you help me with my buttons, Dailin?" Elaine was proud of how steady her voice was. She had expected this, just not with so many witnesses, she thought faintly. Turning her back on Taim, at least she would not have to see him watching her, she began with the tiny buttons on her sleeves. "Dailin, if you please. Dailin?" After a moment, Dailin moved as if sleepwalking and began fumbling with the buttons down Elaine's back, muttering to herself in shocked tones. One of the Ashaman by the doors snickered. "About turn," Taim snapped, and boots stamped by the doors. Elaine did not know whether he had turned away as well. She was certain she could feel his eyes on her. But suddenly Brigitte was there, and Marilla, and Rena, and Zaida, and even Renila, crowding shoulder to shoulder, scowling as they formed a wall between her and the men. Not a very adequate wall. None were as tall as she, and neither Zaida nor Marilla stood higher than her shoulder. "Focus," she told herself. "I am composed. I am tranquil. I'm stripping naked in a room full of people is what I am." She undressed as hurriedly as she could, letting her dress and shift fall to the floor, tossing her slippers and stockings on top of them. Her skin pebbled in the cool air. Ignoring the chill just meant she was not shivering. And she rather thought the heat in her cheeks might have something to do with that. "Madness," Dailin muttered in a low voice, snatching up the clothes. "Utter madness." "What is this about?" Brigitte whispered. "Should I come with you?" "I must go alone," Elaine whispered back. "Don't argue." Not that Brigitte gave any outward sign of it, but the bond carried volumes. Taking the golden hoops from her ears, she handed them to Brigitte, then hesitated before adding her great serpent ring. The wise ones had said she must come as a child came to birth. They had had a great many instructions, first among them to tell no one what was coming. For that matter, she wished she knew. A child came to birth without foreknowledge of what was to happen. Brigitte's muttering began to sound like Dailin's. Nadir came forward with the cloak, but simply held it out. Elaine had to take it and wrap it around herself hastily. She was still sure she could feel Taim's gaze. Holding the heavy wool close, her instinct was to hurry from the room, but instead she drew herself up and turned around slowly. She would not scurry out, cloaked in shame. The men who had come with Taim stood rigidly, facing the doors, and Taim himself was peering at the fireplace, arms folded across his chest. The feel of his eyes had been imagination then. Excepting Nadir, the other women looked at her in variations of curiosity, consternation, and shock. Nadir merely seemed impatient. Elaine tried for her most queenly voice. "Mistress Harfour, you will offer Master Taim and his men wine before they go?" Well, at least it did not tremble. "Dailin, please entertain the Wave Mistress and the Windfinder and see if you can allay their fears. Brigitte, I expect to hear your plan for recruiting tonight." The women she named blinked in startlement, nodded wordlessly. Then she walked from the room, followed by Nadir, wishing she could have done better. The last thing she heard before the door closed behind her was Zaida's voice. "Strange customs you shorebound have." In the corridor she tried to move a little faster, though it was not easy while keeping the cloak from gaping. The red and white floor tiles were much colder than the carpets in the sitting room. A few servants, warmly bundled in good woolen livery, stared when they saw her, then hurried on about their tasks. The flames of the stand lamps flickered. There were always drafts in the hallways. Occasionally the air stirred enough to make a wall hanging ripple lazily.
"That was on purpose, wasn't it?" she said to Nadir, not really asking a question. "Whenever you called me, you'd have made sure there were plenty of people to watch, to make sure adopting Avienda was important enough to me." It had to be more important than anything else they had been told.
"What did you do to her?"
Avienda seemed to have very little modesty sometimes, often walking around her apartments unclothed and unconcerned, not even noticing when servants entered. Making her undress in a crowd would have proved nothing.
"That is for her to tell you if she wishes," Nadir said complacently. "You are sharp to see it. Many do not."
Her large bosom heaved in a grunt that might have been a laugh. "Those men turning their backs, and those women guarding you. I would have put a stop to it if the man in the embroidered coat had not kept looking over his shoulder to admire your hips, and if your blushes had not said you knew."
Elaine missed a step and stumbled. The cloak flared, losing the little body warmth it had trapped before she could snatch it closed again.
"That filthy pig kisser," she growled. I'll
burn her? What could she do? Tell Rand? Let him deal with Taim? Never in life.
Nadir eyed her quizzically. "Most men enjoy looking at a woman's bottom. Stop thinking about men, and start thinking about the woman you want for a sister."
Flushing again, Elaine put her mind on Avienda. It did nothing to settle her nerves. There were specific things she had been told to think on before the ceremony, and some made her uneasy.
Nadir kept her pace to Elaine's, and Elaine took great care not to let her legs flash through the cloak's opening. There were servants everywhere, so it took them some little time to reach the room where the wise ones were gathered, more than a dozen of them in their bulky skirts and white blouses and dark shawls, decked with necklaces and bracelets of gold and silver, gems and ivory, their long hair held back with folded scarves. All the furnishings and carpets had been cleared out, leaving bare white floor tiles, and there was no fire on the hearth. Here, deep in the palace with no windows, the crash of thunder was barely audible. Elaine's eyes went straight to Avienda, standing on the far side of the room, naked. She smiled at Elaine nervously. Nervously? Avienda? Hurriedly throwing off the cloak, Elaine smiled back. Nervously, she realized. Avienda gave a soft laugh, and after a moment Elaine did, too. Light! The air was cold, and the floor was colder. She did not know most of the wise ones in the room, but one face jumped at her. Amisa's prematurely white hair combined with features that appeared short of their middle years to give her something of the look of an Aes Sedai. She must have traveled from Kyrian. Egwene had been teaching the Dreamwalkers to repay their teaching about Tel Iron Riod, and to meet a debt, she claimed, though she had never made clear what debt. "I hoped Milane would be here," Elaine said. She liked Bale's wife, a warm and generous woman, not like two others in the room she recognized, bony Tamela with her angular face, and Viendra, a beautiful blue-eyed eagle. Both were stronger in the power than she, stronger than any sister she had met save Nynaeve. That was not supposed to matter among Aiel, but she could think of no other reason why they always sneered and looked down their noses when they saw her. She expected Amis to take charge. Amis always did, it seemed. But it was a short woman named Monaella, her hair yellow with hints of red, who stepped forward. Not truly short, yet still the only woman in the room shorter than Elaine, and the weakest in the power, too, barely strong enough, had she gone to Tar Valon, to have earned the shawl. Perhaps that really did not count with Aiel.
"Were Milane here," Monaella said, her tone brisk but not unfriendly, "the babes she carries would be part of the bond between you and Avienda if the weaves brushed them. If they survive, that is, the unborn are not strong enough for this. The question is, are the two of you?" She gestured with both hands, pointing to spots on the floor not far from her. "Come here to the middle of the chamber, both of you." For the first time, Elaine realized that Saidar was to be part of this. She had thought it would be just a ceremony, pledges exchanged, perhaps oaths given. What was going to happen? It did not matter, except... Her steps dragged as she moved toward Monaella. "My warder, our bond,
Will she be affected by this?
Avienda, coming to face her, had frowned when Elaine hesitated, but at the question she swung startled eyes to Monaella. Clearly it was something she had not thought of. The short, wise one shook her head.
No one outside this chamber can be touched by the weaves. She may sense some part of what you share with each other because of her bond with you, but only a very little.
Avienda heaved a sigh of relief that Elaine echoed.
Now, Monaella went on, there are forms to be followed. Come, we are not clan chiefs discussing water pledges over Usquai.
Laughing, making what seemed to be jokes about clan chiefs and the strong Aiel liquor, the other women formed a circle around Avienda and Elaine. Monaella settled gracefully to the floor, sitting cross-legged 2 paces to one side of the bare women. Laughter ceased as her voice became formal.
We are gathered because 2 women wish to be first sisters. We will see whether they are strong enough, and if they are, help them. Are their mothers present?
Elaine gave a start, but the next moment Viendra was behind her.
I stand for Elaine Trakan's mother, who cannot be here.
Hands on Elaine's shoulders, Viendra pushed her forward and pressed down until she was kneeling on the cold tiles in front of Avienda, then knelt behind her.
I offer my daughter to her testing.
Tamella appeared behind Avienda, pressing her down with her knees almost touching Elaine's, kneeling at her back.
I stand for Avienda's mother who cannot be here. I offer my daughter to her testing.
Another time Elaine might have giggled. Neither woman looked more than a half dozen years older than Avienda or her. Another time. Not now. The standing wise ones wore solemn faces. They were studying her and Avienda as if weighing them, unsure they would measure up.
Who will suffer the pangs of birth for them? Monaella asked, and Amis stepped forward.
2 others came with her, a fiery redhead named Shianda, whom Elaine had seen with Milane, and a graying woman she did not know. They helped Amis strip to her skin. Proud in her nakedness, Amis faced Monaella and slapped her taut belly.
I have borne children. I have given suck, she said, cupping breasts that looked as if she had done nothing of the kind. I offer myself.
At Monaella's dignified nod of acceptance, Amis went to her knees 2 paces on the other side of Elaine and Avienda and settled back on her heels. Shianda and the graying wise one knelt, flanking her, and suddenly the glow of the power surrounded every woman in the room except Elaine, Avienda, and Amis. Elaine took a deep breath and saw Avienda do the same. Occasionally a bracelet clicked against another among the wise ones, the only sound in the room beyond breathing and faint distant thunder. It was almost a shock when Monaella spoke.
You will both do as you are instructed. If you waver or question, your dedication is not strong enough. I will send you away, and that will be the end of it forever. I will ask questions, and you will answer truthfully. If you refuse to answer, you will be sent away. If any here think you lie, you will be sent away. You may leave at any time on your own, of course, which also will end this for all time. There are no second chances here. Now, what is the best you know of the woman you want for a first sister?
Elaine half expected the question. This was one of the things she had been told to think about. Choosing one virtue among many had not been easy, yet she had her answer ready. When she spoke, flows of Saidar suddenly wove together between her and Avienda, and no sound came from her tongue or Avienda's. Without thought, a part of her mind tucked away the weaves. Even now, trying to learn was as much a part of her as the color of her eyes. The weaves vanished as her lips closed.
Avienda is so confident, so proud. She doesn't care what anyone thinks she should do or be. She is who she wants to be,
Elaine heard her own voice say, while Avienda's words suddenly were audible at the same time.
Even when Elaine is so afraid that her mouth dries, her spirit will not bend. She is braver than anyone I have ever known.
Elaine stared at her friend. Avienda thought she was brave? Light. She was no coward, but brave? Strangely, Avienda was staring at her in disbelief.
Courage is a well, Viendra said at Elaine's ear. Deep in some, shallow in others. Deep or shallow, wells go dry eventually, even if they fill again later. You will face what you cannot face. Your spine will turn to jelly, and your vaunted courage will leave you weeping in the dust. The day will come. She sounded as though she wanted to be there to see it come. Elaine gave a curt nod. She knew all about her spine turning to jelly. She fought it every day, it seemed. Tamela was speaking to Avienda in a voice almost as satisfied as Viendra's.
Je Ito binds you like bands of steel. For Je, you make yourself exactly what is expected of you to the last hair. For To, if necessary, you will abase yourself and crawl on your belly, because you care to your bones what everyone thinks of you.
Elaine nearly gasped. That was harsh and unfair. She knew something of Je Ito, but Avienda was not like that. Yet Avienda was nodding, much as she herself had, an impatient acceptance of what she already knew.
"Fine traits to love in a first sister," Monaella said, lifting her shawl down to her elbows. "But what do you find worst in her?"
Elaine shifted on her chilling knees, licked her lips before speaking. She had dreaded this. It was not just Monaella's warning. Avienda had said they must speak the truth. Must, or what was sisterhood worth? Again the weaves held their words captive until they were done.
"Avienda..." Elaine's voice said suddenly, hesitantly. She thinks violence is always the answer. At times she won't think beyond her belt knife. At times she's like a boy who won't grow up.
Elaine knows that, Avienda's voice began, then gulped and went on in a rush.
She knows she is beautiful, knows the power it gives her over men. She exposes half her bosom sometimes in the open air, and she smiles to make men do what she wants.
Elaine gaped. Avienda thought that of her? It made her sound a light skirt. Avienda frowned back and half opened her mouth, but Tamela pressed her shoulders again and began to speak.
You think men do not stare at your face in approval?
There was an edge in the wise one's voice. Strong was the best anyone would ever say of her face.
Do they not look at your breasts in the sweat tent? Admire your hips? You are beautiful and you know it. Deny it and deny yourself. You have taken pleasure in men's looks and smiled at them. Will you never smile at a man to give your arguments more weight, or touch his arm to distract him from the weakness of your arguments? You will, and you will be no less for it.
Red flooded Avienda's cheeks, but Elaine was having to listen to Viendra and fight blushes of her own.
There is violence in you. Deny it and deny yourself. Have you never raged and struck out? Have you never drawn blood? Have you never wished to, without considering another way, without any thought at all? While you breathe, that will be part of you.
Elaine thought of Taim and other times, and her face felt like a furnace. This time there was more than one response.
Your arms will grow weak, Tamela was telling Avienda. Your legs will lose their swiftness. A youth will be able to take the knife from your hand. How will skill or ferocity avail you then? Heart and mind are the true weapons. But did you learn to use the spear in a day when you were a maiden? If you do not hone mind and heart now, you will grow old, and children will befuddle your wits. Clan chiefs will sit you in a corner to play cat's cradle, and when you speak, all will hear only the wind. Take heed while you can.
Beauty flees, Viendra went on to Elaine. Years will make your breast sag, your flesh grow slack, your skin grow leathery. Men who smile to see your face will speak to you as if you were just another man. Your husband may see you always as the first time his eyes caught you, but no other man will dream of you. Will you no longer be you? Your body is only clothing. Your flesh will wither, but you are your heart and mind, and they do not change except to grow stronger.
Elaine shook her head. Not in denial. Not really. She had never thought on aging, though. Especially not since going to the tower. The years lay lightly even on very old Aes Sedai. But what if she lived as long as the kinswomen? That would mean giving up being Aes Sedai, of course, but what if she did? The kin took a very long time to grow wrinkles, but grow them they did. What was Avienda thinking? She knelt there looking sullen.
"What is the most childish thing you know of the woman you want for a first sister?"
Monaella said.
This was easier, not so fraught.
Elaine even smiled as she spoke. Avienda grinned back, sullenness gone.
Again the weaves took their words and released them together, voices with laughter in them.
"Avienda won't let me teach her to swim. I've tried. She isn't afraid of anything except getting into more water than a bathtub."
Elaine gobbles sweets with both hands like a child who's escaped her mother's eye. If she keeps on, she will be fat as a pig before she grows old.
Elaine jerked. Gobbles? Gobbles?
A taste, now and then, was all she took. Just now and then. Fat? Why was Avienda glaring at her? Refusing to step into water more than knee-deep was childish.
Monaella covered a slight cough with one hand, but Elaine thought she was hiding a smile. Some of the standing wise ones laughed outright.
At Avienda's silliness?
Or her gobbling?
Monaella resumed dignity, adjusting her skirts spread out on the floor, but there was still a touch of mirth in her voice.
What is your greatest jealousy of the woman you want for a first sister?
Perhaps Elaine would have hedged her answer despite the requirement for truth. Truth had jumped up as soon as she was told to think on this, but she had found something smaller, less embarrassing for them both that would have passed muster. Perhaps. But there was that about her smiling at men and exposing her bosom. Maybe she did smile, but Avienda walked in front of red-faced serving men without a stitch on and seemed not even to see them. So she gobbled candy, did she? She was going to get fat? She spoke the bitter truth while the weaves took her words and Avienda's mouth moved in grim silence until at last what they had said was loosed.
Avienda has lain in the arms of the man I love. I never have. I may never. And I could weep over it. Elaine has the love of Randolph. Of Rand. My heart is dust for wanting him to love me, but I do not know if he ever will.
Elaine peered into Avienda's unreadable face. She was jealous of her over Rand? When the man avoided Elaine Trakand as if she had scabies? She had no time for more thought.
"Strike her as hard as you can with your open hand," Tamella told Avienda, removing her own hands from Avienda's shoulders.
Viendra squeezed Elaine's lightly. "Do not defend yourself." They had not been told anything of this. Surely Avienda would not... Blinking, Elaine pushed herself up from the icy floor tiles. Gingerly she felt her cheek, and winced. She was going to wear a palm print the rest of the day. The woman did not have to hit her that hard.
Everyone waited until she was kneeling again, and then Viendra leaned closer. "Strike her as hard as you can with your open hand."
Well, she was not going to knock Avienda on her ear. She was not going to... Her full-armed slap sent Avienda sprawling, sliding on her chest across the tiles almost to Monaella. Elaine's palm stung almost as much as her cheek. Avienda half pushed herself up, gave her head a shake, then scrambled back to her position. And Tamella said, "Strike her with the other hand." This time Elaine slid all the way to Amisa's knees on the frozen tiles, her head ringing, both cheeks burning. And when she regained her own knees in front of Avienda, when Viendra told her to strike, she put her whole body into the slap, so much that she nearly fell over atop Avienda as the other woman went down.
"You may go now," Monaella said.
Elaine's eyes jerked toward the wise one. Avienda, halfway back to her knees, went stiff as stone.
"If you wish to," Monaella continued. "Men usually do, at this point, if not sooner. Many women do, too. But if you still love one another enough to go on, then embrace."
Elaine flung herself at Avienda and was met with a rush that nearly knocked her over backwards. They clung together. Elaine felt tears trickling from her eyes and realized Avienda was crying as well.
"I'm sorry," Elaine whispered fervently. "I'm sorry, Avienda."
"Forgive me," Avienda whispered back.
"Forgive me."
Monaella was standing over them now.
"You will know anger at one another again. You will speak harsh words. But you will always remember that you have already struck her, and for no better reason than you were told to. Let those blows pass for all you might wish to give. You have to toward one another. To you cannot repay and will not try to, for every woman is always in her first sister's debt. You will be born again."
The feel of Sidar in the room was changing, but Elaine had no chance to see how, even had she thought of it. The light dwindled as if the lamps were being put out. The feel of Avienda's hug dwindled. Sound dwindled. The last thing she heard was Monaella's voice. "You will be born again." Everything faded. She faded. She ceased to exist. Awareness, of a sort. She did not think of herself as she. She did not think at all, but she was aware. Of sound. A liquid swishing all around. Muted gurgles and rumbles. And a rhythmic thudding. That above all. Th-thud. Th-thud. She did not know contentment, but she was content. Th-thud. Time. She did not know time, yet ages passed. There was a sound within her, a sound that was her. Th-thud. The same sound, the same rhythm as the other. Th-thud. And from another place, nearer. Th-thud. Another. Th-thud. The same sound, the same beat as her own. Not another. They were the same. They were one. Th-thud. Forever went by to that pulse, all the time that had ever been. She touched the other that was herself. She could feel. Th-thud. She moved, she and the other that was herself, writhing against one another, limbs entangling, rolling away but always coming back to each other. Th-thud. There was light sometimes in the darkness, dim beyond seeing, but bright to one who had never known anything but darkness. Th-thud. She opened her eyes, stared into the eyes of the other that was herself, and closed hers again, content. Th-thud. Change, sudden, shocking to one who had never known any change. Pressure. Th-thud, th-thud. That comforting beat was faster. Convulsive pressure. Again, again, getting stronger. Th-thud, 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 th-thud. Suddenly the other that was herself was gone. She was alone. She did not know fear, but she was afraid and alone. Th-thud, th-thud. Pressure, greater than anything before, squeezing her, crushing her. If she had known how to scream, if she had known what a scream was, she would have shrieked. And then light, blinding, full of swirling patterns. She had weight. She had never felt weight before. A cutting pain at her middle. Something tickled her foot. Something tickled her back. At first she did not realize that wailing sound was coming from her. She kicked feebly, waved limbs that did not know how to move. She was lifted, laid on something soft but firmer than anything she had felt before, except for recollections of the other that was herself, the other that was gone. Th-thud, th-thud. The sound. The same sound, the same beat. Loneliness reigned, unrecognized, but there was contentment, too. Memory began to return, slowly. She lifted her head from a breast and looked up into Amice's face. Yes, Amice. Sweat-slick and weary-eyed, but smiling. And she was Elaine. Yes, Elaine Trakand. But there was something more to her now. Not like the warder bond, but like it in a way. Fainter, but more magnificent. Slowly, on a neck that wobbled uncertainly, she turned her head to look at the other that was herself, lying on Amice's other breast. To look at Avienda, her hair matted, her face and body shining with sweat. Smiling with joy. Laughing, weeping, they clutched each other and hung on, as if they never intended to let go. "This is my daughter, Avienda," Amice said. "And this is my daughter, Elaine, born on the same day within the same hour. May they always guard one another, support one another, love one another." She laughed softly, tiredly, fondly. "And now will someone bring us garments before my new daughters and I all freeze to death?" Elaine did not care at that moment if she did freeze to death. She clung to Avienda in laughter and tears. She had found her sister. Light! She had found her sister! Tovain Ghazal woke to the sounds of quiet bustle, other women moving about, some talking softly. Lying on her hard, narrow cot, she sighed with regret. Her hands around Elida's throat had been just a pleasant dream. This tiny, canvas-walled room was reality. She had slept poorly, and she felt thinned, drained. She had overslept, too. There would be no time for breakfast. Reluctantly, she tossed off her blankets. The building had been a small warehouse of some sort, with thick walls and heavy rafters low overhead, but there was no heat. Her breath misted, and the crisp morning air pricked through her shift before her feet reached the rough floorboards. Even if she could have considered lying abed in this place, she had her orders. Loghain's filthy bond made disobedience impossible, no matter how often she wished it. She always tried to think of him as simply Ablar, or at worst, Master Ablar, but it was always just Loghain that came into her mind, the name he had made infamous. Loghain, the false dragon who had shattered the armies of his native Gildan. Loghain, who had carved a path through the few Altarans and Mirandians, with nerve enough to try stopping him until he threatened Lugard itself. Loghain, who had been gentled and somehow could channel again, who had dared to fix his cursed weave of Saidin on Tovain Ghazal. A pity for him he had not commanded her to stop thinking. She could feel the man in the back of her head. He was always there. For a moment she squeezed her eyes shut. Light! Mistress Doweel's farm had seemed the pit of doom, years of exile and penance with no way out except the unthinkable, to become a hunted renegade. Barely half a week since her capture, she knew better. This was the pit of doom, and there was no mistake. Angrily, she shook her head and scrubbed glistening dampness from her cheeks with her fingers. No, she would escape, somehow, if only for long enough to put her real hands on Elida's throat. Somehow. Aside from the cot, there were only three pieces of furniture, yet they left little space for her to move. She cracked the ice in the yellow-striped pitcher on the washstand with her belt knife, filled the chipped white basin, and channeled to heat the water till tendrils of steam rose. It was allowed to channel for that. That and no more. By rote she washed and scrubbed her teeth with salt and soda, then took a fresh shift and stockings from the small wooden chest at the foot of the cot. Her ring she left in the chest, tucked under everything else in a small velvet pouch. Another order. All of her things were here, except for her lap desk. Luckily, that had been lost when she was taken. Her dresses hung on a cloak stand, the last of the room's furnishings. Choosing one without really looking, she put it on mechanically and used comb and brush on her hair. The ivory-backed brush slowed as she really saw herself in the washstand's cheap, bubbled mirror. Breathing raggedly, she set the brush down beside the matching comb. The dress she had chosen was thick, finely woven wool of an unadorned red so dark it seemed nearly black. Black, like an Ashaman's coat. Her distorted image stared back at her, lips writhing. Changing would be a sort of surrender. Determinedly, she snatched her marten-lined gray cloak from the stand. When she pushed aside the canvas door flap, 20 or so sisters already occupied the long central hallway lined with canvas rooms. Here and there a few were speaking in murmurs, but the rest avoided each other's eyes, even when they belonged to the same Aja. Fear had its presence, but it was shame that coated most faces. Akura, a stout gray, was staring at the hand where she normally wore her ring. Dasandra, a willowy yellow, was hiding her right hand in her armpit. The soft conversations trailed off when Tovain appeared. Several women glared at her openly, including Jannara and Lamai from her own Aja. Dasandra came to herself enough to turn her back stiffly. In the space of 2 days, 51 Aes Sedai had fallen captive to the black-coated monsters, and 50 of them blamed Tovain Ghazal as though Elida Arroyhan had no hand in the disaster at all. Except for Loghain's intervention, they would have had their revenge their first night here. She did not love him for putting a stop to it, and making Carnila heal the welts left by belts, the bruises left by fists and feet. She would rather they had beaten her to death than owe him. Putting her cloak on her shoulders, she walked proudly down the corridor, out into pale morning sunshine that suited her washed-out mood. Behind her, someone shouted acid words before the closing door cut them off. Her hands trembled as she pulled up her hood, nestling the dark fur around her face. No one got away with pushing down Tovain Ghazal. Even Mistress Doweel, who had crushed her into a semblance of submission over the years, learned that when her exile ended. She would show them. She would show them all. The dormitory she shared with the others lay on the very edge of a large village, if a very strange one. A village of Ashaman. Elsewhere, so she had been told, ground was marked off for structures they claimed would dwarf the White Tower, but this was where most of them lived now. 5 large, blocky stone barracks, spaced along streets as wide as anything in Tarvalin, could each hold 100 Ashaman soldiers. They were not full yet, the light be thanked, but snow-covered scaffolding awaited the arrival of workmen around the thick walls of two more that were almost ready for roofing in thatch. Nearly a dozen smaller stone structures were made to hold 10 dedicated each, and another of those was under construction, too. Scattered around them stood nearly 200 houses that might have been seen in any village, where some of the married men lived, and the families of others not far enough along in training. Men who could channel did not frighten her. Once she had given in to panic for a moment, true, but that was beside the point. 500 men who could channel, however, were a scrap of bone wedged between two of her teeth where she could not free it. 500! And they could travel, some of them. A sharp scrap of bone. More, she had tramped the mile or more through the woods to the wall. That frightened her. What it signified. Nowhere was the wall finished. Nowhere more than 12 or 15 feet high. None of the towers or bastions more than begun. In places she could have clambered over the piles of black stone, except for her orders not to attempt escape. The thing ran for 8 miles, though, and she believed Loghain when he said it was begun less than 3 months ago. The man held her too tightly to bother with lying. He called the wall a waste of time and effort, and perhaps it was, but it made her teeth chatter. Just 3 months, made using the power, the male half of the power. When she thought of that black wall, she saw an implacable force that could not be stopped. An avalanche of black stone sliding down to bury the white tower. Impossible, of course. Impossible, but when she did not dream of strangling Elida, she dreamed of that. There had been snowfall in the night, and a heavy blanket of white covered every roof, but she did not have to pick her way along the broad streets. The hard-packed dirt had been cleared, a chore of men in training before the sun came up. They used the power for everything from filling wood boxes to cleaning their clothes. Black-clad men hurried here and there in the streets, and more were gathering in rows in front of their barracks, with others calling roll in loud voices. Women bundled up against the cold walked past them, placidly carrying baskets to the quartermaster's storehouse or water buckets to the nearest fountain, though how any woman could remain, knowing what her husband was beyond Tovain's comprehension. Even more bizarre, children ran up and down the street, around the squares of men who could channel, shouting and laughing, rolling hoops, tossing painted balls, playing with dolls or dogs. A drop of normality that heightened the evil stench of the rest. Ahead of her, a mounted party was approaching up the street at a walk. In the short time she had been here, the endless time, she had not seen anyone ride in the village except workmen on carts or wagons, nor any visitors, which some of these plainly must be. 5 men in black were escorting a dozen in the red coats and cloaks of the Queen's Guards, with 2 yellow-haired women at the front, one in a red and white cloak lined with black fur, and the other... Tovain's eyebrows climbed. The other wore green Kandori trousers and a coat made up as if it belonged to the Captain General of the Guard. Her red cloak even had golden knots of rank on the shoulder. Maybe she was mistaken about the men. That one would find short shrift when she encountered real guardsmen. In any case, it was strangely early for visitors. Each time the odd party reached one of the formations, the man in front shouted, "Ashaman, attend front!" and boot-heels stamped on the hardened earth as the others stiffened like pillars of stone. Pulling her hood forward better to hide her face, Tovain moved to the side of the wide street, close beside the corner of one of the smaller stone barracks. A fork-bearded old man coming out, a silver sword pin on his high collar, glanced at her curiously without slowing his stride. What she had done struck her like a bucket of cold water, and she nearly wept. None of those strangers would spot an Aes Sedai face now if they could recognize one. If either of those women could channel, unlikely though that was, she would not pass close enough to tell that Tovain could too. She fretted and fumed over how to disobey Loghain, and then did everything necessary to carry out his instructions without even thinking about it. As an act of defiance, she stopped where she was, turning to watch the visitors. Automatically, her hands checked her hood before she could snatch them to her sides. It was pitiful and ridiculous. She knew the Ashaman guiding the party, by sight at least, a bulky man in his middle years with oily black hair, an oily smile, and eyes like augers. none of the others, though. What could she hope to gain by this? How could she entrust a message to any of them? Even if the escort vanished, how could she get close enough to pass a message when she was forbidden to let any outsider discover the presence of Aes Sedai? The augur-eyed fellow looked bored with his duty this morning, hardly bothering to hide his yawns behind a gloved hand.
"When we do finish here," he was saying as he rode past Tovain, "I will show you the craft town, quite a bit bigger than this. We do have every kind of craftsfolk, from masons and carpenters to metalsmiths and tailors. We can make everything we need, Lady Elaine."
"Except turnips," one of the women said in a high voice, and the other laughed. Tovain's head jerked. She watched the riders move on down the street, accompanied by shouted orders and stamping boots. "Lady Elaine? Elaine Trakand?" The younger of the pair might match the description she had been given. Elida did not reveal why she was so desperate to lay her hands on one runaway accepted, even one who might become a queen, but she never let a sister leave the tower without orders on what to do if she encountered the girl. "Be very careful, Elaine Trakand," Tovain thought. "I would not like Elida to have the satisfaction of laying hands on you." She wanted to think on this, on whether there was some way to use the girl's presence here, but abruptly she became aware of the sensations at the back of her head. A mild contentment and a growing purpose. Loghain had finished his breakfast. He would be coming out soon. He had told her to be there when he did. Her feet were running before she thought, with the result that her skirts tangled in her legs and she fell hard, knocking her breath out. Anger welled up, fury, but she scrambled to her feet, and without pausing to brush off the dust, gathered her skirts above her knees and began to run again, cloak billowing behind. Men's raucous shouts followed her down the street, and laughing children pointed as she ran past. Suddenly a pack of dogs was around her, snarling, nipping at her heels. She leapt and spun and kicked, but they harried her. She wanted to shriek with frustration and fury. Dogs were always a bother, and she could not channel a feather to drive them off. A grey hound seized a mouthful of dangling skirt, pulling her sideways. Panic overwhelmed everything else. If she fell again, they would tear her to shreds. A shouting woman in brown wool swung her heavy basket at the dog tugging Tovain's skirt, making it dodge away. A round woman's bucket caught a brindled cur in the ribs, and it ran yelping. Tovain gaped in astonishment, and for her inattention had to pull her left leg away from another dog at the cost of a piece of her stocking and a little skin. There were women all around her, flailing away at the animals with whatever they had to hand.
"Gone with you, Aes Sedai," a skinny graying woman told her, slicing at a spotted dog with a switch. "They won't bother you more. I'd like a nice cat myself, but cats won't abide the husband now. Go on."
Tovain did not wait to thank her rescuers. She ran, considering furiously. The women knew. If one did, they all did. But they would carry no messages, give no help to an escape, not when they were willing to remain themselves, not if they understood what they were helping. There was that. Just short of Loghain's house, one of several down a narrower side street, she slowed and hastily let down her skirts. 8 or 9 men in black coats were waiting outside, boys and oldsters and in between, but there was no sign of Loghain yet. She could still sense him, full of purpose, but concentrating. Reading, perhaps. She walked the rest of the way at a dignified pace. Composed and every inch in Aes Sedai, no matter the circumstances. She almost managed to forget her frantic flight from the dogs. The house surprised her every time she saw it. Others on the street were as large and two larger. An ordinary wooden house of 2 stories, though the red door, shutters, and window frames looked odd. Plain curtains hid the interior, but the glass in the windows was so poor she doubted she could have seen anything clearly with the curtains drawn. A house suitable for a not overly successful shopkeeper, hardly the dwelling for one of the most notorious men alive. Briefly she wondered what was keeping Gabrella. The other sister bonded to Loghain had the same instruction she did, and until now she'd always been here first. Gabrella was eager, studying the Ashaman as if she intended writing a book on the subject. Perhaps she did. Browns would write about anything. She put the other sister out of her mind. Although, if Gabrella did turn up late, she would have to find out how the woman had managed it. For now, she had her own studying. The men outside the red door eyed her, but said nothing, even to each other. Still, there was no animosity. They were simply waiting. None had a cloak, though their breath made pale feathers in front of their faces. All were dedicated, with the silver sword pin on their collars. It had been the same every morning she had reported this way, though not always the same men. She knew some, knew their names at least, and sometimes a few other gleaned tidbits. Evan Vinchova, the pretty lad who had been there when Loghain captured her, leaning against the corner of the house and toying with a bit of string. Donalo Sandomir, if that was his real name, with his creased farmer's face and sharply trimmed oiled beard, attempting the languid stance he thought a nobleman would assume. The Taraboner Andral Genhald, a square fellow with his heavy eyebrows drawn in thought and his hands clasped behind his back. He wore a gold signet ring, but she thought him an apprentice who had shaved his mustaches and abandoned his veil. Mezar Kurin, a Domani with gray at his temples, fingering the garnet in his left ear. He very well might be a minor noble. She was collecting a neat file of names and faces in her head. Sooner or later they would be hunted down, and every piece of information that could help identify them would be useful. The red door opened, and the men straightened, but it was not Loghain who came out. Tovain blinked in surprise, then met Gabrella's sooty green eyes with a flat stare, making no effort to hide her disgust. That accursed link with Loghain had made clear what he was up to the night before. She had been afraid she would never fall asleep, but not in her darkest imaginings had she suspected Gabrella. Some of the men seemed as startled as she. Some attempted to hide smiles. Kurin grinned openly and stroked his thin mustache with a thumb. The dusky woman did not even have the grace to blush. She lifted her upturned nose a trifle, then boldly adjusted her dark blue dress over her hips, as if to advertise that she had just donned the garment. Sweeping her cloak around her shoulders, she tied the ribbons as she glided toward Tovain, as serene as if she were back in the tower. Tovain grabbed the taller woman's arm, pulling her a little way from the men. "We may be captives, Gabrella," she whispered harshly, "but that is no reason to surrender, especially to Ablar's vile lusts." The other woman did not so much as look abashed. A thought came. "Of course. Did he order you?" With something close to a sneer, Gabrella pulled free. "Tovain, it took me 2 days to decide I should surrender to his lusts, as you put it. I feel lucky it only required 4 to convince him to let me. You Reds might not be aware, but men love to talk and gossip. All you need do is listen, or even pretend to, and a man will tell you his whole life." A thoughtful frown creased her forehead, and the twist to her lips vanished. "I wonder whether it's like that for ordinary women." "Whether what is like what?" Tovain demanded. "Gabrella was spying on him? Or just trying to get more material for her book? But this was unbelievable, even for a Brown. What are you talking about?" That musing expression never left the other's face. "I felt helpless. Oh, he was gentle, but I never really thought before on how strong a man's arms are, and me unable to channel a whisker. He was in charge, I suppose, though that isn't quite right. Just stronger, and I knew it. It felt strangely exhilarating." Tovain shuddered. Gabrella must be insane. She was about to tell her so when Loghain himself appeared, closing the door behind him. He was tall, taller than any other man there, with dark hair that brushed wide shoulders and framed an arrogant face. His high collar carried both the silver sword and that ridiculous snake with legs. He flashed a smile at Gabrella as the others gathered around him. The hussy smiled back, too. Tovain shuddered again. Exhilarating. The woman was insane. As on previous mornings, the men began making reports. Most of the time, Tovain had not been able to make up from down with them, but she listened.
"I found 2 more who seem interested in that new kind of healing this Nynaeve used on you, Loghain," Genhald said, frowning. "But one can barely do the healing we already know, and the other, he wants to know more than I could tell him." "What you can tell him is all I know," Loghain replied.
Mistress Almira didn't tell me much of what she was doing, and I could only learn bits and pieces listening to the other sisters talk. Just keep planting the seed and hope something grows. It's all you can do.
Several other men nodded along with Genhald. Tovain filed it away. Nynaeve Almira. She had heard that name often after returning to the tower. Another runaway accepted. Another one Elida wanted more than the normal desire to catch runaways seemed to account for. From the same village as Althor, too. And associated somehow with Loghain. That might lead to something, eventually. But a new kind of healing? Used by an accepted? That was unlikely, bordering close on impossible, but she had seen the impossible happen before, so she tucked it away. Gabriella was listening closely, too, she noticed, but watching her as well, out of the corner of her eye.
"There's a problem with some of those Two Rivers men, Loghain," Vinchova said. An angry flush rose on his smooth face. "Men, I say, but these two are boys, 14 at most. They won't say."
He might have been a year or two older, with his beardless cheeks.
"It was a crime bringing them here."
Loghain shook his head. Whether in anger or regret, it was hard to say.
"I've heard the White Tower takes girls as young as 12. Look after the Two Rivers men where you can. No coddling or the others will turn on them, but try to see they don't do anything stupid. The Lord Dragon might not like it if we kill too many from his district."
"He doesn't seem to be caring much at all, as I can see," a sleek fellow muttered. The sound of Murundi was strong in his mouth, though his fiercely curled mustaches told where he was from plainly enough. He was rolling a silver coin across the backs of his fingers, and seemed as intent on that as on Loghain.
"I was hearing it was the Lord Dragon himself told the Mahale to pluck up anything male in this Two Rivers that could channel down to the roosters. With the number he brought back, I'm just surprised he didn't bring the chicks and lambs as well."
Chuckles met his sally, but Loghain's level tones cut them like a blade.
"Whatever the Lord Dragon ordered, I trust I've made my orders clear."
Every head nodded this time, and some men murmured, "Yes, Loghain," and, "As you say, Loghain." Tovain hastily smoothed the sneer from her lips. Ignorant louts. The tower accepted girls under 15 only if they had already begun channeling. The other was interesting, though. The Two Rivers again. Everyone said Althor had turned his back on his home, but she was not so certain. Why was Gabriella watching her?
"Last night," Sandomir said after a moment, "I learned that Mishraela is having private lessons from the Mahale."
He stroked his pointed beard with satisfaction, as if he had produced a gem of great price. Perhaps he had, but Tovain could not say what kind. Loghain nodded slowly. The others exchanged silent looks with faces that might have been carved. She chewed frustration, watching. Too often it was like this, matters they saw no reason to comment on, or feared to, and she did not understand. She always felt there were gems hidden there beyond her reach. A wide Kyrianin fellow, barely as tall as Loghain's chest, opened his mouth, but whether he meant to speak of Mishraela, whoever he was, she never found out.
"Loghain!"
Wellin Kajima pounded down the street at a dead run, the bells at the ends of his black braids jangling. Another dedicated, a man in his middle years who smiled too much, he had been there when Loghain captured her, too. Kajima had bonded Janara. He was almost out of breath when he pushed through the other men, and he was not smiling now.
"Loghain," he panted. "The Mahale's back from Kyrian, and he's posted new deserters on the board at the palace. You won't believe the names!"
He spilled out his list in a breathless rush amid exclamations from the others that kept Tovain from hearing more than fragments.
"Dedicated have deserted before," the Kyrianin muttered when Kajima was done, "but never a full Ashaman. And now 7 at once?"
"If you don't believe me,"
Kajima began, drawing himself up in a fussy manner. He had been a clerk in Arafel.
"We believe you," Genhald said soothingly. "But Gedwin and Torval, they are the Mahale's men. Rochide and Kismen, too. Why would they desert? He gave them anything a king could want."
Kajima shook his head irritably, making his bells chime.
"You know the list never gives reasons, just names."
"Good riddance," Kurin growled. "At least it would be if we didn't have to hunt them down now."
"It's the others I cannot understand," Sandomir put in. "I was at Dumai's wells. I saw the Lord Dragon choose after. The Shiva had his head in the clouds like always. But Flynn, Hopwill, Narishma? You never saw men more pleased. They were like lambs let loose in the barley shed." A sturdy fellow with gray in his hair spat.
"Well, I wasn't at the wells, but I went south against the Seanchan."
His accents were Andoran.
"Maybe the lambs didn't like the butcher's yard as much as they did the barley shed."
Loghain had been listening without taking part, arms folded across his chest. His face was unreadable, a mask.
"Do you worry about the butcher's yard, Canler?" he said now.
The Andoran grimaced, then shrugged.
"I reckon we're all headed there soon or late, Loghain. Don't see we have much choice, but I don't have to grin about it."
"As long as you're there on the day," Loghain said quietly.
He addressed the man called Canler, but several of the others nodded. Looking past the men, Loghain considered Tovain and Gabrella. Tovain tried to look as if she had not been eavesdropping and remembering names fiercely.
"Go inside out of the cold," he told them. "Have some tea to warm you. I'll be back as soon as I can. Don't touch my papers."
Gathering up the other men with a gesture, he led them off in the direction Kajima had come from. Tovain gritted her teeth in frustration. At least she would not have to follow him to the training grounds, past the so-called traitor's tree, where heads hung like diseased fruit from the bare branches, and watch men studying how to destroy with the power. But she had hoped for another day to herself, free to wander about and see what she could learn. She had heard men speak of Taim's palace before, and today she had hoped to find it and perhaps catch a glimpse of the man whose name was as black as Loghain's. Instead, she meekly followed the other woman through the red door. There was no use fighting it. Inside, she looked around the front room while Gabrella hung her cloak on a peg. Despite the exterior, she had expected something grander for Loghain. A low fire burned in a rough stone fireplace. A long, narrow table and ladder-backed chairs stood on bare floorboards. A desk, only slightly more elaborate than the other furnishings, caught her eye. Stacks of lidded letterboxes littered the desktop, and leather folders full of long sheets of paper. Her fingers itched, but she knew that even if she sat at the desk, she would not be able to lay a finger on anything more than the pen or glass ink bottle. With a sigh, she followed Gabrella into the kitchen, where an iron stove gave too much heat, and dirty breakfast dishes sat on a low cabinet beneath the window. Gabrella filled a tea kettle and put it on the stove, then took a green glazed teapot and a wooden canister from another cabinet. Tovain draped her cloak over a chair and sat down at the square table. She did not want tea unless it came with the breakfast she had missed, but she knew she was going to drink it. The silly brown nattered on as she carried out her domestic tasks like a contented farm wife. "I've learned a good deal already. Loghain is the only full Ashaman to live here in this village. The others all live in Taim's palace. They have servants, but Loghain hired the wife of a man in training to cook and clean for him. She'll be here soon, and she thinks he put the sun in the sky, so we best be done talking anything important by then. He found your lap desk." Tovain felt as though an icy hand had seized her throat. She tried to hide it, but Gabrella was looking straight at her. "He burned it, Tovain, after reading the contents. He seemed to think he had done us a favor." The hand eased, and Tovain could breathe again.
"Elida's order was among my papers."
She cleared her throat to rid herself of hoarseness.
"Elida's order to gentle every man found here and then hang them on the spot, without the trial in Tarvalin required by Tower law. She imposed harsh conditions, and these men would have reacted harshly if they knew."
In spite of the heat from the stove, she shivered. That single paper could have gotten them all stilled and hanged. "Why would he do us favors?"
"I don't know why, Tovain. He isn't a villain, no more than most men. It could be as simple as that."
Gabrella set a plate of crusted rolls and another with white cheese on the table.
"Or it could be that this bond is like the warder bond in more ways than we know. Maybe he just did not want to experience the two of us being executed."
Tovain's stomach rumbled, but she picked up a roll as if she did not care for more than a nibble.
"I suspect harsh was a mild choice of words,"
Gabrella went on, spooning tea into the teapot. I saw you flinch. Of course, they went to a great deal of trouble to bring us here. 51 sisters in their midst, and even with the bond, they must fear we'll find some way around their orders, some loophole they missed. The obvious answer is, if we were dead, the tower would be roused to fury. With us alive and captive, even Elida will move cautiously. She laughed, quietly amused. Your face, Tovain. Did you think I've spent all my time thinking about tangling my fingers in Loghain's hair? Tovain closed her mouth and put down the untouched roll. It was cold, anyway, and felt hard. Always a mistake to assume Browns were unworldly, absorbed in their books and studies to the exclusion of everything else. What else have you seen? Still gripping the spoon, Gabrella sat across the table from her and leaned forward intently. Their wall may be strong when it's done, but this place is full of fractures. There is Mazrim Taim's faction and Loghain's faction, though I am uncertain either thinks of them so. Perhaps other factions, too, and certainly men who don't know there are factions. 51 sisters should be able to make something of that, even with the bond. The second question is, what do we make of it? The second question? Tovain demanded, but the other woman merely waited. If we manage to break those fissures open, she said finally, we scatter 10 or 50 or 100 bands across the world, each more dangerous than any army ever seen. Catching them all might take a lifetime and rip the world apart like a new breaking, and that with Tarman Gaiden on its way. That is, if this fellow Al-Thor really is the Dragon Reborn. Gabrella opened her mouth, but Tovain waved away whatever she was going to say. That he was, very likely. It hardly mattered, here and now. But if we don't... Put down the rebellion and gather those sisters back to the tower, call back every retired sister, and I don't know whether all of us together could destroy this place. I suspect half the tower would die in the attempt either way. What is the first question? Gabrella leaned back in her chair, her face suddenly weary. Yes, not an easy decision. And they bring in more men every day. 15 or 20 since we've been here, I believe. I won't be trifled with, Gabrella. What is the first question? The Brown's gaze sharpened, stared at her for a long moment. Soon the shock will wear off, she said finally. What comes then? The authority Elida gave you is finished. The expedition is finished. The first question is, are we 51 sisters united, or do we revert to being Browns and Reds, Yellows and Greens and Greys? And poor Ayako, who must be regretting that the Whites insisted on having a sister included. Lamai and Asandra stand highest among us. Gabrella waved the spoon in admonishment. The only chance we have of holding together is if you and I publicly submit to Desandra's authority. We must. That will start it at any rate, I hope. If we can only bring a few others to begin with, it will be a start. Tovain drew a deep breath and pretended to stare at nothing, as if considering. Submitting to a sister who stood higher than she was no hardship in itself. The Ajahs had always kept secrets, and sometimes schemed a little against one another, but the open dissension in the tower now appalled her. Besides, she had learned how to be humble before Mistress Doeil. She wondered how the woman enjoyed poverty, and working on a farm for a taskmistress even harsher than herself. "I can bring myself to it," she said finally. "We should have a plan of action to present to Desandra and Lamai if we mean to convince them." She already had one partly formed, if not for presentation to anyone. "Oh, the water is boiling, Gabrella." Suddenly smiling, the foolish woman rose and hurried to the stove. Browns always were better reading books than people, come to think of it. Before Loghain and Taim and the rest were destroyed, they would help Tovain Ghazal bring down Elida.
The great city of Cairhien was a hulking mass inside massive walls, crowding the river Alguenya. The sky was clear and cloudless, but a cold wind blew, and the sun shone on roofs covered with snow, glinted on icicles that showed no sign of melting. The Alguenya was not frozen, but small, jagged ice floes from farther upstream spun in the currents, now and then banging against the hulls of ships waiting their turns at the docks. Trade slowed for winter and wars, and the dragon reborn. But it never really stopped. Not until nations died. Despite the cold, wagons and carts and people flowed along streets that razored the terraced hills of the city. The city, it was called here. In front of the square-towered Sun Palace, a crowd jammed together around the long entry ramp and stared up, merchants wrapped in fine woolens and nobles in velvets rubbing shoulders with grimy-faced laborers and dirtier refugees. No one cared who stood next to him, and even the cut-purses forgot to follow their trade. Men and women departed, often shaking their heads, but others took their places, sometimes hoisting a child to get a better view of the palace's ruined wing, where workmen were clearing away the rubble of the third story. Throughout the rest of Kyrian, craftsmen's hammers and creaking axles filled the air, together with the cries of shopkeepers, the complaints of buyers, the murmurs of merchants. The crowd before the Sun Palace was silent. A mile from the palace, Rand stood at a window in the grandly named Academy of Kyrian, peering through the frosted panes at the stone-paved stable-yard below. There had been schools called academies in Arthur Hawkwing's time and before, centers of learning filled with scholars from every corner of the known world. The conceit made no difference. They could have called it the barn, so long as it did what he wanted. More important concerns filled his thoughts. Had he made a mistake, returning to Kyrian so soon? But he had been forced to flee too quickly, so it would be known in the right quarters that he actually had fled. Too quickly to prepare everything. There were questions he needed to ask, and tasks that could not be put off. And Min wanted more of Master Fell's books. He could hear her muttering to herself as she rummaged through the shelves where they had been stored after Fell's death. With the bounty for books and manuscripts it did not yet possess, the Academy's library was fast outgrowing the rooms that could be spared in Lord Barthanas's former palace. Alana sat in the back of his head, sulking, it seemed. She would know he was in the city. This near, she would be able to walk straight to him. But he would know if she tried. Blessedly, Luz Theron was silent for the moment. Of late, the man seemed madder than ever. He rubbed a spot clear on a window pane with his coat sleeve. Stout, dark gray wool, good enough for a man with a little money and few heirs, it was not a garment anyone would expect to see on the Dragon Reborn. The golden-maned dragon's head on the back of his hand glittered metallically. It presented no danger here. His boot touched the leather scrip, sitting below the window, as he leaned forward to look out. In the stable-yard, the paving stones had been swept clear of snow, and a large wagon stood surrounded by buckets like mushrooms in a clearing. Half a dozen men in heavy coats and scarves and caps seemed to be working on the wagon's odd cargo, mechanical devices crowded around a fat metal cylinder that took up more than half the wagon bed. Even stranger, the wagon shafts were missing. One of the men was moving split firewood from a large wheelbarrow into the side of a metal box fastened below one end of the big cylinder. The open door in the box glowed with the red of fire inside, and smoke rose from a tall, narrow chimney. Another fellow danced around the wagon, bearded, capless, and bald-headed, gesturing and apparently shouting orders that did not seem to make the others move any faster. Their breath made faint white plumes. It was almost warm inside. The academy had large furnaces in the cellars and an extensive system of vents. The half-healed, never-healing wounds in his side were hot. He could make out Min's curses. He was sure they were curses, but her tone was enough to say they would not be leaving yet unless he dragged her away. There were one or two items he might ask about still. "What are people saying about the palace?" "What you might expect," Lord Dobrain answered behind him with level patience, as he had answered all the other questions. Even when he admitted a lack of knowledge, his tone had not changed. "Some say the Forsaken attacked you, or that Aes Sedai did. Those who think you swore fealty to the Amaran Seat favor the Forsaken. Either way, there is considerable debate on whether you are dead or kidnapped or fled. Most believe you live, wherever you are, or say they do. Some, a good many, I fear, think..." His voice faded to silence. "That I've gone mad," Rand finished for him in the same level tone. not a matter for concern or anger. That I destroyed part of the palace myself? He would not speak of the dead. Fewer than other times, other places, but enough, and some of their names appeared whenever he closed his eyes. One of the men below climbed down from the wagon, but the bald fellow caught his arm and dragged him back up, making him show what he had done. A man on the other side jumped to the pavement carelessly, skidding, and the capless man abandoned the first to chase around the wagon and make that one climb back up with him. What in the light could they be doing? Rand glanced over his shoulder. They're not far wrong. Dobrain Taborwin, a short man with the front of his head shaved and formally powdered and the rest of his hair nearly all gray, looked back with dark, impassive eyes. Not a handsome man, but steady. Blue and white stripes marched down the front of his dark velvet coat from his neck almost to his knees. His signet ring was a carved ruby, and he wore another at his collar, not much larger, yet flamboyant for a Kyrianin. He was high seat of his house, with more battles behind him than most, and not much frightened him. He had proved that at Dumai's Wells. But then the stocky, graying woman patiently waiting her turn at his shoulder appeared just as unafraid. In sharp contrast to Dobrain's noble elegance, Idrian Tarson's sensible brown woolens were plain enough for a shopkeeper, yet she had her own well of authority and dignity. Idrian was headmistress of the academy, the title she had given herself since most of the scholars and mechanics called themselves master of this or mistress of that. She ran the school with a strong hand and believed in practical things, new methods of surfacing roads or making dyes, improvements to foundries and mills. She also believed in the dragon reborn. Whether or not that was practical, it was pragmatic, and he would settle for that. He turned back to the window and cleared his patch on the glass again. Maybe it was for heating water. Some of those buckets seemed to have water in them still. In Shinar, they used big boilers to heat water for the baths. But why on a wagon? Has anyone left suddenly since I went, or come unexpectedly? He did not expect that anyone had, anyone of importance to him. Between merchants' pigeons and White Tower eyes and ears, and Mazarim Taim, he must not forget Taim. Luz Theron snarled wordlessly at the name. With all those pigeons and spies and babbling tongues, in a few more days the whole world would be aware that he had vanished from Kyrian. All the world that mattered, here and now. Kyrian was no longer the ground where the battle would be fought. Dobrain's answer surprised him.
No one except Ailil Riatan and some high sea folk official are both missing since the attack.
A bare pause, but a pause. Perhaps he was not so sure what had happened either. Yet he would keep his word. He had proved that at Dumai's Wells, too.
No bodies were found, but they may have been killed. The Seafolk Wave Mistress refuses to countenance the possibility, though. She is raising a storm with demands that her woman be produced. In truth, Ailil may have fled to the countryside, or gone to join her brother, despite her pledges to you. Your three Ashaman are still in the Sun Palace, Flynn, Narishma, and Hopwill. They make people nervous, more so now than before.
The headmistress made a sound in her throat, and her shoes shifted audibly on the floorboards. They certainly made her nervous. Rand dismissed the Ashaman. Unless much closer than the palace, none was strong enough to have felt him open a gateway here. Those three had not been part of the attack on him, but a wise planner might have considered the chance of failure, planned how to keep someone close to him if he survived.
"You won't survive," Luz Theron whispered. "None of us will survive."
"Go back to sleep," Rand thought irritably. He knew he was not going to survive, but he wanted to. A derisive laugh answered in his head, but the sound thinned and was gone. The bald man was letting the others climb down now, and rubbing his hands together in a pleased fashion. Of all things, the fellow seemed to be giving a speech.
"Ailill and Shellen are alive,
"'And they didn't flee,' Rand said aloud.
"'He had left them bound and gagged, stuffed under a bed, "'where they would have been found by servants in a few hours, "'though the shield he had woven on the Seafolk Windfinder "'would have dissipated before that. "'The two women should have been able to free themselves then.
"'Look to Cadswain. "'She'll have them in Lady Arlen's palace.'
"'Cadswain Sedai is in and out of the Sun Palace, "'as if it were her own.' "'Dobryn said judiciously. "'But how could she have taken them out unseen? "'And why? "'Ailill is Torum's sister, "'yet his claim to the Sun Throne is dust now, "'if it was ever more. "'She is unimportant even as a counter now. "'As for holding an Atha'an Mir of high rank, "'to what purpose?'
"'Rand made his voice light, uncaring.' "'Why is she keeping Lady Caroline and High Lord Darlin as guests, Dobryn? "'Why do Aes Sedai do anything? "'You'll find them where I said, if she lets you in to look.' "'Why was not a foolish question. "'He just did not have the answer. "'Of course Caroline Damodred and Ailill Rhiannon "'did represent the last two houses to hold the Sun Throne.' And Darlin Cisnera led the nobles in Tyr, who wanted him thrown out of their precious stone, out of Tyr. Rand frowned. He had been sure Cadswain was focused on him despite her pretense otherwise. But what if it was not pretense? A relief, if so. Of course it was. The last thing he needed was an Aes Sedai who thought she could meddle in his affairs. The very last. Perhaps Cadswain was directing her meddling elsewhere. Min had seen Cisnera wearing a strange crown. Rand had thought a great deal of that viewing of hers. He did not want to think of other things she had seen concerning himself and the Green Sister. Could it be as simple as Cadswain thinking she could decide who would rule both Tyr and Cairhien? Simple? He almost laughed. But that was how Aes Sedai behaved. And Shallan, the Windfinder— Possessing her might give Cadswain leverage with Harina, the Wave Mistress, but he suspected she had just been scooped up with Ailill to try hiding who took the noble woman. Cadswain would have to be disabused. Who would rule in Tyr and Cairhien had already been decided. He would point that out to her. Later. It stood far down his list of priorities.
Before I go, Dobryn, I need to give you...
Words froze on his tongue. In the stable yard, the capless man had pulled a lever on the wagon, and one end of a long horizontal beam suddenly rose, then sank, driving a shorter beam down through a hole cut in the wagon bed. And, vibrating till it seemed ready to shake apart, trailing smoke from the chimney, the wagon lurched ahead, the beam rising and falling, slowly at first, then faster. It moved... Without horses. He did not realize he had spoken aloud until the headmistress answered him.
Oh, that. That's Mervyn Pole's steam wagon, as he calls it, my lord dragon.
Disapproval freighted her high, startlingly youthful voice.
Claims he can pull 100 wagons with the contraption. Not unless he can make it go further than 50 paces without bits breaking or freezing up. It has only done that far once that I know.
Indeed, the steam wagon shuddered to a halt not 20 paces from where it first stood. Shuddered indeed, it seemed to be shaking harder by the heartbeat. Most of the men swarmed over it again, one of them frantically twisting at something with a cloth wrapped around his hand. Abruptly, steam shot into the air from a pipe, and the shuddering slowed, stopped. Rand shook his head. He remembered seeing this fellow, Mervyn, with a device that quivered on a tabletop and did nothing. And this marvel had come from that. He had thought it was meant to make music. That must be Mervyn leaping about and shaking his fists at the others. What other odd things, what marvels were people building here at the Academy? When he asked, still watching the men in the courtyard work on the wagon, Idrian sniffed loudly. Respect for the dragon reborn held only a thin edge in her voice as she began, and quickly lost ground to disgust.
Bad enough I must give space to philosophers and historians and arithmetists and the like, But you said take in anyone who wanted to make anything new and let them stay if they showed progress. I suppose you hoped for weapons. But now I have dozens of dreamers and wastrels on my hands, every one with an old book or manuscript, or six, all of which date back to the Compact of the Ten Nations, mind, if not the Age of Legends itself, or so they say. And they are all trying to make sense of drawings and sketches and descriptions of things they've never seen, and maybe nobody ever did see. I have seen old manuscripts that talk about people with their eyes in their bellies, and animals 10 feet tall with tusks longer than a man, and cities where—
But what are they making, Headmistress Tarson? Rand demanded. The men working on the thing below moved with an air of purpose, not as if they saw failure. And it had moved. She sniffed louder this time.
Foolishness, my lord dragon. That is what they make. Ken Tovir constructed his big looking glass. You can see the moon through it, plain as your hand. And what he claims are other worlds. But what is the good of that? He wants to build a bigger now. Meryl Harka makes huge kites she calls gliders, and come spring she will be throwing herself off hills again. Put your heart in your mouth to see her sailing downhill on the things. She will break more than her arm next time one folds up on her, I warrant. Jander Parentakis believes he can move riverboats with water wheels off a mill, or near enough, but when he put enough men into the boat to turn the cranks, there was no room for cargo, and any craft with sails could outrun it. Rinanhara traps lightning in big jars. I doubt even he knows why. And Niko Takama is just as silly with her.
Rand spun around so fast that she stepped back, and even Dobrain shifted on his feet, a swordsman's move. No, they were not sure of him at all.
He traps lightning? He asked quietly.
Comprehension fluttered her blunt face, and she waved her hands in front of her.
No, no, not like that.
Not like you, she had almost said.
It is a thing of wires and wheels and big clay jars, and the light knows what. He calls it lightning, and I saw a rat jump down on one of the jars once, on the metal rods sticking out of the top. It certainly looked struck by lightning.
A hopeful tone entered her voice.
I can make him stop, if you wish.
He tried to picture someone riding on a kite, but the image was ludicrous. Catching lightning in jars was beyond his ability to imagine. And yet... Let them go on as before, Headmistress. Who knows? Maybe one of those inventions will turn out to be important. If any work is claimed, give the inventor a reward. Dobrain's leathery, sun-darkened face looked dubious, though he almost managed to conceal it. Idrian bowed her head in sullen assent, and even curtsied, but plainly she thought he was asking to let pigs fly if they could. Rand was not certain he disagreed. Then again, maybe one of the pigs would grow wings. The wagon had moved. He wanted very badly to leave something behind, something to help the world survive the new breaking the prophecies said he would bring. The trouble was he had no idea what that might be, save for the schools themselves. Who knew what a marvel could do? Light, he wanted to build something that could last.
I thought I could build, Luce Theron murmured in his head. I was wrong. We are not builders, not you or I, or the other one. We are destroyers. Destroyers.
Rand shivered and scrubbed his hands through his hair. The other one? At times the voice sounded sanest when it was the most mad. They were watching him, Dobrain very nearly hiding uncertainty, Idrian making no effort to. Straightening as if nothing was wrong, he drew two slim packets from inside his coat. Both carried the dragon in a long lump of red wax on the outside. The belt buckle he was not wearing at the moment served for an impressive signet. "The top one names you my steward in Kyrian," he said, handing the packets to Dobrain. A third, still nestled next to his chest, for Gregorin den Loshenos, making him steward in Ilion. "So there'll be no trouble with anyone questioning your authority while I'm gone." Dobrain could handle that sort of trouble with his armsmen, but best to make sure no one could claim ignorance or doubt. Maybe there would be no trouble to handle if everyone believed the Dragon Reborn would descend on transgressors. There are orders about things I want done, but aside from those, use your own judgment. When the Lady Elaine lays claim to the Sun Throne, throw your full support behind her. Elaine. Oh, Light, Elaine and Avienda. At least they were safe. Min's voice sounded happier now. She must have found Master Fell's books. He was going to let her follow him to her death, because he was not strong enough to stop her.
Ilyena,
Luthieren moaned.
Forgive me, Ilyena.
Rand's voice came out as cold as winter's heart. You'll know when to deliver the other. Whether to deliver it. Pry him out, if need be, and decide by what he says. If you decide no, or he refuses, I'll pick someone else, not you. Perhaps that was brusque, but Dobrain's expression hardly changed. His eyebrows rose slightly at the name written on the second packet, that was all. He made a smooth bow. Kyrianen usually were smooth.
It shall be as you say. Forgive me, but you sound as though you mean to be gone a long while.
Rand shrugged. He trusted the High Lord as far as he trusted anyone. Almost as far. Who can say? The times are uncertain. Make sure Headmistress Tarson has whatever coin she needs, and the men starting the school in Camelin. The school in Tyr as well, until matters change there.
As you say,
Dobrain repeated, tucking the packets into his coat. His face betrayed no emotion now. An experienced player in the game of houses was Dobrain. For her part, the headmistress managed to look pleased and disgruntled at the same time, and busied herself smoothing her dress unnecessarily, the way women did when hard-pressed not to speak their minds. Complain how she would about dreamers and philosophers, she was jealous of the Academy's well-being. She would shed no tears if those other schools vanished and their scholars were forced to come to the Academy. Even the philosophers. What would she think of one particular order in Dobrain's packet? I've found everything I need, Min said, coming out from the shelves, staggering slightly under the weight of the three bulging cloth scripts that hung from her. Her plain brown coat and breeches were very like what she had worn when he first saw her in Baerlan. For some reason she had grumbled over them until anyone who knew her would have thought he was asking her to put on a dress. She smiled now, though, with delight and a hint of mischief. I hope those pack horses are where we left them, or my Lord Dragon will have to be fitted for a pack saddle. Idrian gasped, scandalized to hear him addressed so, but Dobrain merely smiled a little. He had seen men around Rand before. Rand got rid of them as quickly as possible, since they had heard and seen as much as he wanted them to, sent them off with a final admonition that he had never been there at all. Dobrain nodded as if he had expected no less. Idrian looked thoughtful as she left. If she let anything slip where a servant could hear, or a scholar, it would be all over the city in 2 days. There was not much time in any case. Perhaps no one who could tell had been close enough to feel him open a gateway here, but anyone looking for the signs would be sure by now there was a Taviren in the city. It was not his plan to be found yet. When the door closed behind them, he studied Min for a moment, then took one of the scripts and slung it from his shoulder.
"Only one," she said.
Setting the others on the floor, she planted her fists on her hips and scowled.
"Sometimes you really are a sheep herder. These bags must be 100 weight each."
But she sounded more amused than upset. "You should have picked smaller books," he told her, pulling on riding gloves to hide the dragons. "Or lighter." He turned toward the window to fetch the leather scrip, and a wave of dizziness hit him. Knees turning to water, he stumbled. A shimmering face he could not make out flashed through his head. With an effort, he caught himself, forced his legs straight, and the whirling sensation vanished. Luthieren panted hoarsely in the shadows. Could the face be his?
"If you think you'll make me carry them all that way, think again," Min grumbled. "I've seen better pretending from stable hands. You could try falling down." Not this time. He was ready for what happened when he channeled. He could control it to some extent. Usually. Most of the time. This dizziness without Cydene was new. Maybe he had just turned too fast. And maybe pigs did fly. He settled the leather script's strap over his free shoulder. The men in the stable yard were still busy. Building. Min. Her brows lowered immediately. She paused for an instant and, drawing on her red gloves, and began tapping her foot. A dangerous sign with any woman, especially one who carried knives.
We had this out, Rand bloody dragon reborn Althor. You are not leaving me behind.
The thought never crossed my mind, he lied. He was too weak. He could not make himself say the words to make her stay. Too weak, he thought bitterly. And she might well die for it. The light burn me forever. It will, Luce Theron promised softly. I just thought you should know what we've been doing and what we are going to do, Rand went on. I haven't been very forthcoming, I suppose. Gathering himself, he seized Cydene. The room seemed to whirl, and he rode the avalanche of fire and ice and filth with nausea seething in his belly. He was able to stand erect without swaying, though. Barely. And just able to weave the flows of a gateway that opened into a snowy clearing where two saddled horses were tethered to a low branch of an oak. He was glad to see the animals still there. The clearing was well away from the nearest road, but there were still wanderers who had turned their backs on families and farms, trades and crafts, because the dragon reborn had broken all bonds. The prophecies said so. On the other hand, a good many of those men and women, footsore and half-frozen now on top of it, were tired of searching without any notion of what they were searching for. Even these nondescript mounts surely would have vanished with the first man to find them unattended. He had gold enough to buy others, but he did not think Min would have enjoyed the hour's walk to the village where they had left the pack horses. Hurrying through into the clearing, pretending the change from floor to knee-deep snow caused his stumble, he only waited until she had snatched up her bags of books and staggered through after him before releasing the power. They were 500 miles from Kyrian, and nearer Tarvalen than anywhere else of note. Alana had faded in his head when the gateway closed.
Forthcoming, Min said, sounding suspicious.
Of his motives, he hoped, or anything but the truth. The dizziness and nausea faded slowly.
You have been as open as a muscle, Rand, but I am not blind. First we traveled to Rudion, where you asked so many questions about this Shara place that anybody would think you meant to go there.
Frowning faintly, she shook her head as she fastened one of her burdens to the saddle of her brown gelding. She grunted with the effort, but she was not about to set the other bag of books down in the snow.
I never thought the Aiel Waste was like that. That city is bigger than Tarvalen. Even if it is half-ruined. And all those fountains in the lake? I couldn't even see the far side. I thought there wasn't any water in the waste, and it was as cold as here. I thought the waste was hot.
In summer, you fry during the day, but you still freeze at night. He felt recovered enough to begin shifting his own burdens to the gray saddle. Almost enough. He did it anyway. If you already know everything, what was I doing besides asking questions?
The same as in Tyr last night. Making sure every cat and blackbird knew you were there. In Tyr it was Chachin you asked about. It's obvious. You are trying to confuse anyone who tries to find out where you are and where you're going next.
The second bag of books balancing the first behind her saddle, she untied her reins and climbed into the saddle.
So, am I blind?
Your eyes belong on an eagle. He hoped his pursuers saw as clearly. Or that whoever directed them did. It would not do to have them herring off the light new wear. I need to lay some more false trails, I think.
Why take the time? I know you have a plan. I know it concerns something in that leather scrip. A Sangreal? And I know it's important. Don't look so surprised. You barely let that bag out of your sight.
Why not go ahead and do whatever it is you plan, then lay your false trails? And the real one, of course. You're going to turn on them when they least expect you, you said. You can hardly do that unless they follow where you want.
I wish you'd never started reading Herod Fell's books, he muttered sourly, pulling himself into the gray saddle. His head spun only a little. You puzzle out too much. Can I keep any secrets at all from you now?
You never could, Woolhead, she laughed, and then contradicting herself, what are you planning?
Aside from killing Dashiva and the rest, I mean. I have a right to know if I'm traveling with you.
As if she had not insisted on traveling with him.
I'm going to cleanse the male half of the source, he said in a flat voice.
A momentous announcement. A grand scheme. More than grand. Grandiose, most would say.
He might have said he intended to take an afternoon stroll for all of Min's reaction. She simply looked at him, hands folded on the pommel of her saddle, until he went on. I don't know how long it will take, and once I start, I think everyone within 1,000 miles of me who can channel will know something is happening. I doubt I'll be able to just stop if Dashiva and the rest, or the Forsaken, suddenly appear to see what it is. The Forsaken, I can't do anything about. But with luck, I can finish the others. Maybe being Tavirin would give him the edge he needed so desperately. Depend on luck, and Corlin Dashiva, or the Forsaken, either one will have you for breakfast, she said, turning her horse out of the clearing. Maybe I can think of a better way. Come on. There's a warm fire at that inn. I hope you're going to let us have a hot meal before we leave.
Rand stared after her incredulously. You would have thought 5 renegade Ashaman, not to mention the Forsaken, were less bother than a sore tooth. Booting the gray ahead in a spray of snow, he caught up to her and rode in silence. He still had a few secrets from her. This sickness that had begun affecting him when he channeled, for one. That was the real reason he had to deal with Dashiva and the others first. It gave him time to get over the sickness. If that was possible. If not, he was not sure the 2 Tirangrial, riding behind his saddle, were going to be any use at all.